not think that I wrote in any way a racist book.
6 episodes considering different perspectives. Anatomy of a Cancellation starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Wednesday morning at 9:30.
And you're listening to BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Monday the 10th of November. This is Today with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. The headlines today: MPs are calling on the BBC to act to restore trust after the resignations of its Director General and Head of News over the way Panorama edited a Donald Trump speech. We'll ask why they've both resigned now and hear why some people think there's been a political coup. And the other main headline this morning: a deal which could end the US government shutdown has been approved by the Senate.
Also in today's programme, the government plans to give 16-year-olds the vote at the next general election. So how do they get their news? How do they form their opinions? A new study begins to find the answers. And the prize-winning author Dame Penelope Lively tells us what's special about writing for children ahead of the launch of a new Booker Prize for children's literature tonight.
There's this extraordinary liberation about it. The writer of children's books can kind of discard the boundaries of time and place.
That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
The BBC is facing calls to prioritise restoring trust with its audiences as it begins a search for a new Director General and Head of News. Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus announced their resignations yesterday evening after criticism of how a Panorama documentary edited a speech by President Trump. The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, is expected to address their departures today when he responds to concerns about editorial standards raised by a committee of MPs. Here's our media correspondent, David Sillitoe.
The original plan for today was that the BBC would merely provide answers to the Commons Media Select Committee about why a clip of a Donald Trump speech in a Panorama was spliced together from 2 separate sections, 54 minutes apart. But events have moved on, with not one but 2 resignations. Tim Davey, the Director General, said it wasn't the whole reason he'd chosen to go, but no one doubts it certainly determined the timing. The Chief Executive of News, Deborah Turnus, said the controversy around Panorama was causing damage to the BBC and mistakes had been made, but denied BBC News was institutionally biased. That issue had been raised by Michael Prescott, a former independent editorial adviser at the BBC whose concerns led to a series of stories in the papers. He will meet MPs later this week. The BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, said it was a difficult day for the BBC. What began as a series of questions about a Panorama has become a crisis, with the corporation now looking for candidates for its 2 biggest jobs.
The resignations of Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus have been welcomed by President Trump. Writing on social media last night, he said they were caught doctoring his speech, and he accused them of trying to step on the scales of a presidential election. With her analysis of where the episode leaves the BBC, here's our media editor, Katie Razzle.
On the face of it, Tim Davies' departure makes some sense. As his statement makes clear, the Director General had been under intense personal and professional pressure. As the controversies mounted, he didn't seem his usual buoyant self. My assessment is that he didn't have enough oil in the tank for another fight. The claims about Panorama and the edit of President Trump's speech were very damaging to the BBC. The corporation needed to get on the front foot and either apologise or defend itself. I understand a statement had been prepared days ago to apologise, but that was blocked by the board. I'm told there was outright hostility towards the CEO of News, Deborah Turnus, in a crisis meeting on Thursday. It had decided a letter to the Culture, Media and Sport Committee was preferable. But for a week, claims about the BBC and editorial bias were allowed to fester. It's a moment of real crisis for the corporation, and there will be questions about who governs it.
The US Senate has approved a deal aimed at ending the government shutdown that has lasted nearly 6 weeks. Many government operations have ground to a halt and hundreds of thousands of federal workers have gone without pay. Anthony Zerker reports from Washington.
8 Democrats in the 100-seat Senate joined all but one of the Republicans to approve a stopgap measure that will fund all government services until the end of January. In addition, a few government departments and programs, including low-income food aid, will be funded until October. Democrats had been demanding an extension of health insurance subsidies for tens of millions of Americans, but they made little progress, with Republicans only agreeing to put that to a vote in the Senate. The House of Representatives will also have to approve the funding bill before it can be sent to Donald Trump for his signature.
The Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, will have talks with President Trump today. He'll be the first Syrian leader to visit the White House since his country's independence nearly 80 years ago. The US once had a $10 million bounty on Mr. Sharaa's head when he led a group affiliated with al-Qaeda. The United Nations Climate Change Summit, COP30, opens today in the Brazilian city of Belém. From there, our climate editor Justin Rowlatt reports.
Donald Trump has made his priorities clear. His goal is American energy dominance, driven by an aggressive expansion of fossil fuel production. The agenda for this conference could not be more different. Brazil's President Lula da Silva says he wants these talks to deliver concrete action on cutting planet warming emissions and to reaffirm the power of multilateralism. Whether that vision can prevail over the wishes of individual governments will determine the success of this summit, as well as progress on tackling global warming.
Research from the charity Crisis suggests there were around 189,000 more homeless families in England last year than government statistics indicated. This report from Jack Fenwick.
The government's data is influential when it comes to policy and funding in this area, and is based on people declaring themselves as homeless to a local authority. This new research from Crisis found almost 300,000 families faced what it called the worst kinds of homelessness last year, including rough sleeping, living in tents and cars, or unsafe B&Bs. That's a record figure, partly driven by a large increase in the amount of unsuitable temporary accommodation. But the charity says nearly two-thirds of those families didn't make it onto the official data. The government says it's investing more than £1 billion in homelessness services this year, and a more comprehensive homelessness strategy is set to be launched next month.
And more than 120 red kite chicks have been sent from England to southwest Spain over the last 4 years to help bring the species back from the brink of extinction there. Conservationists were granted special licenses to collect the chicks and send them abroad. The birds have been fitted with GPS backpacks to allow them to be tracked.
Thank you, Alan. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's see what the weather has in store for us today. Simon King's here. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Anna. Yes, good morning, everybody. Quite a messy picture through today, and actually through this week, we're going to see spells of rain moving in. Some of that could be quite heavy, so it's something we need to keep a close eye on in the forecast. But for today in southwest England and Wales, we've got some clear skies this morning, a bit of sunshine around, but some thunderous showers will move into Cornwall, and they'll spread north and eastward to all parts by lunchtime. Later this afternoon, the showers will be a bit more scattered, but there'll be some sunnier spells returning in southwest England. Temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, pretty cloudy with some rain, especially across eastern areas. That rain is going to clear away. There'll be some limited brightness before scattered showers move in. And yet again, those could be heavy and thundery, highs of 12 to 14. Across northwest and northeast England, cloudy start with a bit of rain across eastern areas. That's going to clear, some sunny spells developing, but then there'll also be some showers moving in across parts of southern areas of northwest England and highs of 11 to 14 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland today, some rain likely at times, especially across northern areas of Northern Ireland this morning. Southern areas, though, will be a little bit drier, and there'll be some sunny spells developing, temperatures of 9 or 10 Celsius. Now, across Scotland today, it's quite a chilly start, actually, especially in northern Scotland, where there are some clear skies. Some rain, though, across some central and southern areas, which is pretty heavy at the moment. That rain is going to spread north and westward. So later on this afternoon, some drier weather across eastern Scotland and temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. It is now coming up to 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. It's one of those days I almost feel we have to apologise because the news is dominated by news about ourselves, about the BBC, but that is what's on the front pages, so let's reflect what's in them. The resignations at the top of the BBC do feature on almost every front page, alongside a slew of critical headlines. BBC bosses quit in disgrace, says the Daily Mail. Beeb boss quits over Trump lies, says the Sun. According to the Telegraph, the decisions by Tim Davie and Deborah Tennes to step down have left the BBC facing its biggest crisis in more than a decade, with senior MPs demanding a major shake-up, while the Financial Times says the simultaneous departures underline the scale of the problems at the corporation.
The Guardian this morning reports that the resignations have caused shock within the BBC, with a source telling the paper it feels like a coup and the result of a campaign by political enemies of the broadcaster. The Times says insiders have described the fall of the Director General as death by a thousand cuts after a series of scandals led him to conclude that he could no longer continue in the role. But the Daily Telegraph suggests what it calls the blinkered approach of Tim Davey was his undoing, arguing he was furious at critics and blind to the problem.
The leader columns and editorials don't hold back. The Daily Express demands an end to what it calls BBC bias, arguing that across a range of issues, it has consistently gone against the majority opinion in the country or breached broadcasting rules. The Guardian says the BBC needs to fight, but it has given in, warning the corporation looked weak and cowardly as criticism grew over recent days, just when it needed to be robust and brave.
And just a little over 12 hours later, thoughts are now turning to who will be the next Director General. The Times says three women are the early frontrunners to replace Tim Davey. It names them as Jay Hunt, the former controller of BBC One, who now works for Apple TV, Alex Mann, who was the boss of Channel 4 until July, and Charlotte Moore, who left her role as the BBC's Chief Content Officer earlier this year to become the Chief Executive of Left Bank Films.
Now, throughout today's programme, we're going to be hearing reaction to the resignations, those who welcome them and want to see fundamental change at the BBC, those who claim they were in fact the result of a political coup. And after a long night for me of speaking to many inside this organisation, I'll bring you my take of what has just happened at just after 6:30.
Before that, though, it is 6:11 now.
And it's time for the business news. Will is here joining us in the Today programme studio with news, Will, of a feared chips shortage in the auto industry that now appears to be averted.
Yes. Morning, Anna. Morning, Nick. We chatted about this this time last week, in fact, didn't we? An ongoing row between the governments of China and the Netherlands that looked like it could bring some global auto supply chains to a halt. Nexperia is the company we're talking about. Its chips are used by car companies for a range of functions, everything from operating the electric windows to the braking and airbag systems. The Chinese government had been blocking the export of these finished chips, 80% of which come from China, in that row with the Dutch government after they took control of Nexperia, citing their concerns over a Chinese company that was involved. Big companies, Volvo, VW, Ford, Honda, all had been concerned about getting hold of these chips, and that all came to an end, for now at least, on Sunday as China agreed to lift export controls. David Bailey is with us, professor at Birmingham University's Business School and a specialist in the motor industry. David, morning.
Good morning.
Is that the key here? For now, a sigh of relief, or...?
Yes, very much so. For now, China clearly has control over the supply of finished chips from China. And remember, this company, Nexperia, makes huge numbers of these, $100 billion a year. They are not the most advanced chips, but they go into everything. It's literally chips with everything when it comes to the auto industry these days. And the firm represents something like 50% of the supply used by the European auto industry. So China's in a position where it can turn this on and turn this off. For the moment, it's back on again.
Right. And just in terms of how quickly that sort of switch back on again can aid some of these companies. I mean, VW were one of the most vocal, weren't they? Can they get them immediately? Is that quick enough to stop any delays, or are there costs already that these companies will have been racking up?
So I think Honda already shut down a plant in Mexico, given the lack of chips. VW said it was literally a few days away from running out. So whether this is fast enough to get the chips to Europe to keep full production going is not clear at this point. It may be that there is some slowdown, or companies focus on the most profitable models, for example, which is what we saw last time. So hopefully it will minimise the disruption, but there may still be some disruption for the EU auto industry, given that China turned this off and now has turned it back on again.
Yeah, and presumably could do so again if, for example, lots of things out of those companies, out of those European governments, out of our governments here control, if tensions between the US and China ramped up again. China clearly see this a bit like the issue around rare earths as a card to kind of play in those trade tensions. What, as a result, can, is there anything that the auto industry can do, should be doing?
That's I think, the big question for the auto industry. I think certainly this is a wake-up call, I think, for the Dutch government. May well have had good reasons to try and take control, but it hadn't thought through the implications of that. The retaliation from China was swift and it was brutal in stopping all exports. So I think there's a need to think about, well, if these chips are mainly made in Europe still, but then processed in China, to find alternative processing sites, maybe in Southeast Asia or maybe in Europe. The industry also has to look for alternative supplies. They are available, but they take some time to come on stream. And I think the final point is that they, you know, we've got these long supply chains that cross borders many times. They're very lean. There's no stocks. It's just in time. They're vulnerable to political kind of tensions, and maybe there's a need to keep stocks just in case rather than just in time.
Yeah, and presumably as well that this is only an issue that gets more exacerbated. The more cars are hungry for these type of chips, right, the more kind of processors that we have that work in the car, the more we're going to need them as well. So actually the issue is going to become more pressing too.
Yes, it is. It's going to be much more intense. Europe needs to think about, does it need to do this itself and control the supply chain? And that's something China's been thinking about for a very long time, of course, in terms of getting control over rare earths and essentially the materials that go into battery electric vehicles, where essentially it controls something like, you know, 90% of the materials that go into batteries globally. So I think Europe's got to start thinking much more strategically if it wants to try and insulate itself from political pressure.
Professor David Bailey of the Birmingham Business School, thanks so much for your time this morning. Well, Judith McKenzie is also with us this morning. Judith is the partner and head of Downing Fund Managers. Judith, morning.
Morning.
Quick thought on that then and what that means for the big car companies, because their share prices had been taking a bit of a squeeze and with this concern.
Yeah, they had. And to be honest, just listening to that, we're not out of the woods yet. And a couple of things that stem from that, you know, inventory levels probably, when supply does come back on, probably need to go up a little bit. You know, this producer provides nearly 50% of the widgets or components that go into the European automotive industry. And that's one supplier that there's a lot of dependency on. And we've already seen that Honda has pulled back its profit forecasts on the back of this, and Stellantis has set up what they called a war room to try and find alternative suppliers. So it will be interesting this morning to see how share prices react. But I think any rally will be short-lived because we want to see further confirmation that this is a secure supply chain as opposed to something that is at the moment in the middle of a spat.
Yeah, well, let's flip to more domestic matters, a couple of them, but one that's definitely in the category of share price watch as well, because the property company Rightmove, property website Rightmove, its shares were down as much as 25% on Friday, weren't they? This was all after it said it was going to spend a lot of money on AI. Normally, you tell me, you watch this as closely as anybody, but when a company says it's investing AI, recently investors have seemed to have had quite a bit of appetite for that. What didn't they like about this announcement from Rightmove?
I didn't like that it was a big number. So it was £60 million that they're going to be spending on AI over the next couple of years. And that's meant that they're pulling back their operating profit expectations to 3 to 5% growth. But previously that was running closer to 9 to 10% this year. And it's going to have a bit of an impact on operating margins. And I think people are just maybe reading into this a little bit as well, because if they're having to spend that much on search tools and valuation tools and partnering with Google Cloud, are they feeling vulnerable about AI more generally coming in and stealing their business? So,
and does it tell us a little bit more widely, you know, beyond Rightmove? And we've seen it at a very big level too, haven't we, with the likes of the big tech companies in the United States as well. Is there now a bit of a nervousness about the just sheer volumes of cash being spent on AI by companies big and small?
Yeah, because we just don't know what the outcome is. We don't know what the return on investment is going to be. So I think the phrase jam tomorrow was coined on Friday, just feeling as though that we're pushing the can down or kicking the can down the road a little bit and spending quite a lot of money doing it.
Judith, thanks. Stay with us because I might want to get your thoughts on a little bit of this as well, because we've got changes in the City of London. It has its first Lady Mayor of London, Dame Susan Langley, who took over as the head of the City of London Corporation, the body that runs the Square Mile over the weekend, is the third woman to hold the role, but the first to use that title, Lady Mayor. She joins, of course, at a significant time for the city too, with plenty of speculation about what changes there might be in the budget for investors and pensions and how to champion London as a place to invest. And she joins us this morning. Dame Susan, morning, and congratulations, first of all.
Thank you very much. Well, good morning, and I'm now 2.5 days into the job.
I was going to say, how was the weekend? It looked like the glamorous bit of the job at the weekend.
Do you know, Will, you're absolutely right. It really is glamorous. We had fantastic weather. We had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on the street. The show's a brilliant spectacle. I think it's kind of, you know, we have charities, community groups. It's really the soul of London in the city. But that's the ceremonial piece. As you know, the role of the Lord or Lady Mayor is the financial and professional services ambassador for the City of London.
Yeah, exactly. Well, talk to us about a few of those challenges there then. The budget ahead, I think you turn to a different newspaper every day, there's a different bit of speculation about ISA reform or changes to the way investments might be taxed. What are your sort of early messages to the government as you take up this role?
Well, I'm not going to speculate, but the key thing is, please don't tax growth. So, you know, the city is the engine and the powerhouse for the UK. We contribute more than 110 billion to the economy, which in real terms is over half the health and care budget for the UK. And we need to make sure that the city is a place where entrepreneurs want to come, where companies want to grow, where they employ people, you know, where they create innovation, they create livelihoods, they put money back into the economy and pay the tax. So city is a fantastic place to live and work, and we want to make sure it remains so.
Yeah, how to do that growing bit, growing companies. A lot of that has been talking about how we get more capital into the London's financial markets as well. What do you want to hear from the Chancellor around that and the budget too? Obviously, you've been involved before taking up this role in the various kind of Mansion House discussions building up to this, but what needs to be concretely laid out in a couple of weeks' time?
I think in terms of investment and matching investment in growth, one of the great initiatives is the Sovereign 20, which is bringing the asset managers and the insurance together. Because I think what we need is a really clear pipeline of investable opportunities that those companies can partner with government and invest in. So one of the key things for me is a clear pipeline and clarity.
Judith, a quick thought on that.
Welcome, Lady Mayor. Good to have you on board. So if I can maybe just give my wish list from a city perspective. So ISA reform, UK tax benefits, so let's invest in UK companies. So if you could sort that one, that would be great. Pensions, we're only investing 4% of pensions in UK companies. Used to be about 40%, so if we could get that reformed as well. I think you're well on the way to doing that. A little bit of stamp duty reform would be nice. And if you could get the British Business Bank to invest in UK PLCs, not just private companies, then I'd be pretty happy.
Susan, what about that issue that Judith raises about how to get, especially in ISAs, more investment into UK companies? That seems to have split the city, some liking this idea of forcing investors to invest in UK companies, others saying that's a disaster for long-term investment. Where do you stand on that?
I mean, what I think we need to do is I think we need clarity, and I think we need to help people understand the benefits of investing. You know, over 10 years, an ISA cash ISA might pay you just over 1%, and investing in stocks and shares, it's closer to 10. So I'm really supporting the Investment Association. They're leading a kind of a tell seed campaign to show the public of the opportunity of investing in stocks and shares. So for me, it's publicising the benefits.
Yeah. Susan Langley, the new Lady Mayor of the City of London, and Judith McKenzie of Downing Fund Managers. Thanks both for your time this morning.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It is 22 minutes past six. Let's turn to other news now. A powerful typhoon struck the Philippines last night. Jonathan Head is our correspondent on what's called Luzon Island and can tell us more about the impact of that typhoon. Jonathan, how was it?
It was very, very windy. You couldn't move very far from a building because of the kind of debris that was blowing around. Extremely wet, just sheets and sheets of rain. Now, the typhoon's blown through where we are. The town I'm in was very close to where the eye of the storm passed over after it made landfall. It's still pretty blowy. The rain is intermittent, but the damage was nothing like as bad as people feared. There were real worries. This typhoon was about the size of Western Europe. It was absolutely massive, but in the end, the winds weren't as powerful as feared. These appear to have been broken to some degree by the mountain chain that's here. The big worry now is water. So much water has soaked into the mountains. It's all flowing down into the rivers now. We've just been in the neighborhood literally watching the water levels rising and people frantically dashing into their homes. They've been shelters overnight and realizing they had to rescue their pets, their chickens and their furniture. So we've got to see how much of a problem that causes. There are lingering after effects of this typhoon, but generally the country is breathing a sigh of relief. It wasn't as damaging or as destructive to people as the typhoon that hit the country a week ago.
Jonathan Head, thank you very much indeed.
It's 24 minutes past six. Syria's President Ahmed al-Sharaa is in Washington, D.C. today. He will meet President Trump at the White House later. Tom Bateman is our State Department correspondent, and he explained how much of a turnaround this is from the former rebel leader's previous position.
This makes history in more than one way. I mean, it is, in fact, the first visit by a Syrian president ever to the White House since the independence of the country in 1946. So that is saying something. And it gives you a sense, I think, of the embrace that the Americans are very keen to put around Ahmed al-Sharaa. And in particular, because what they see in terms of the win for the Americans and their allies in the region is trying to solidify the dramatic shifts we've seen. So the collapse of Russian and Iranian influence in Syria and try to sort of shore up Damascus and the current momentum under al-Sharaa's leadership to try and, you know, put Damascus firmly in the orbit of the Americans and their allies in the region.
There are various challenges to do with the Kurds in part of the country, to do with sectarian killings that are still going on. Are those being taken seriously by the US administration?
Well, I think the biggest priority for the Trump administration is to try and build on this idea of momentum towards stability. And frankly, I think that matters, you know, a bit more to Donald Trump than sort of pushing for what the administration may see in some ways as sort of unobtainable ambitions towards, you know, fully representative democratic government in a country that is as devastated as it is after 13 years of war. But the reality remains to try and consolidate governance from Damascus and to secure the country, there has to be some form of agreements that are going to be worked on, particularly with, you know, as you said, the Kurdish led SDF in the east of the country. We've seen a lot of very, very bloody sectarian clashes between Arab Bedouin and Druze. As you get down towards the border with the Israeli occupied Golan Heights, which has, you know, created another security crisis during parts of this year. And the Americans on that front want to try to get some kind of security agreement between the Damascus transitional government and the Israelis. And in fact, there has been direct contact, probably for the first time ever, between Syrian officials and the Israelis, or at that level, during the last year or so. So the Americans are trying to push a lot at the same time. How much of it they can achieve and how much of it they'll be able to get into in this conversation today, I think, remains to be seen. But certainly, both symbolically and in terms of some of the practicalities being discussed today, this is obviously a very, very significant moment at the White House.
Tom Bateman, thank you.
It is now 27 minutes past six. A big match in the Premier League yesterday. A defining match in many ways, Mike. Wow.
Yeah, it was spilled, wasn't it, Nick, as the game of the weekend, possibly of the season so far, and it didn't disappoint. And as you allude to, it ended in a statement win for Manchester City.
O'Reilly gives it to Doku. Doku shoots. Surely for Manchester City, done against the champions here in Manchester today.
Yes, a stunning Jeremy Doku goal gave Manchester City a resounding victory over Liverpool by 3-0 at the Etihad yesterday to move them up to second in the Premier League as the City boss Pep Guardiola celebrated his 1,000th game as a manager.
I feel I've been in love since the day I arrived here, how the people take care of me, and all I can do is work hard and do my best. Always Man City, this club will be my home. It's something unique what I experienced in these 10 years, so it's the place I've been the most in these 1,000 games, most here. Especially today, it's the first time in this season that my kids were here, because they already grow up. Each one lives their own life. Today they came to see me, I'm so happy to, you know, celebrate with them like old times.
And we'll reflect more on that match later in the programme. Elsewhere, big win for Aston Villa, who beat Bournemouth by 4-0. Brentford were 3-1 winners over Newcastle. That was the same scoreline at the City Ground as Nottingham Forest beat Leeds. Crystal Palace, Brighton ended goalless. Whilst in the Scottish Premiership, leaders Hearts remained top, undefeated, but did drop points with a second draw in three games. Derek McInnes' side were held 1-1 by Dundee United.
I don't think we should be happy with our performance today. I think we've got to own that. You know, I'm not happy that maybe I've got the team wrong, but I still believe the team can be better than we were today, and we'll need to be better to win games.
Celtic and Rangers are in hot pursuit of the leaders' hearts after big victories for them yesterday. Celtic 4-0 winners over Kilmarnock at home. Rangers won 3-0 away at Dundee. Whilst in the Women's Super League yesterday, there were wins for Manchester City and London City Lionesses. Next to Formula One.
It has been superb for Lando Norris, who wins the Sao Paulo Grand Prix and extends his lead at the top of the Drivers' Championship.
It wasn't the easiest of race in terms of managing tyres, and I think we're missing out a little bit to Max, for instance, who was very fast, but otherwise, yeah, perfect weekend.
Yes, the McLaren's Lando Norris extended his championship lead over teammate and title rival Oscar Piastri to 24 points with a dominant victory at the Sao Paulo Grand Prix yesterday. Next up, Formula One rolls into Las Vegas, just three races to go this season. In tennis, Carlos Alcaraz has moved a step closer to the year-ending world number one ranking with victory over Alex de Minaur at the ATP World Finals in Turin yesterday.
I've been struggling, yeah, the last three years to come to the end of the year with energy. This year is a little bit different, which I'm really proud about the way that I've been doing the things to come here with motivation. And yeah, I'm just really excited and looking forward to giving myself the shot to try to win this tournament.
And finally, in rugby union, another defeat for Wales yesterday. They were beaten 52 points to 28 by Argentina at the Principality. That a record win for Argentina, and we'll have more reflections on that and the whole of the weekend's Autumn International Rugby in the next hour of the programme.
Good, look forward to that. Thank you, Mike. It is 6:30 now. Series 84 of A Classic Comedy begins this evening.
On BBC Radio 4.
Canapes, the Brummy name for tinned peas.
I'm sorry, I haven't a clue.
Enama, a tool for itching chickens.
A new series of the self-styled antidote to panel games, chaired by Jack D.
Sorry, I said that out loud, I didn't mean to.
Featuring Marcus Brigstock, Miles Jupp, Rachel Paris and Adrian Edmondson.
Relax, don't do it.
Absolute filth, and I think you know it.
I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. Monday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It is time at 29 minutes to 7 to get a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The BBC is facing calls to act to restore trust after the resignations of its Director General Tim Davie and Head of News Deborah Turnus because of the way a speech by President Trump was edited in a Panorama documentary. Mr. Davie, who was Director General for 5 years, admitted there had been some mistakes made. Ms. Turnus said the controversy was causing damage to the institution she loved. Mr. Trump welcomed the resignation, saying there had been an attempt to step on the scales of a presidential election. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, called for a top-to-bottom overhaul of the corporation. The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, is expected to address the departures today when he responds to concerns about editorial standards raised by a committee of MPs. US senators have approved a deal which could bring an end to the longest government shutdown in American history. The breakthrough came after 8 Democratic senators agreed to support a stopgap measure put forward by Republicans to extend government funding until the end of January. The legislation now has to be passed by the House of Representatives. The Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, will have talks with President Trump today. The US once had a $10 million bounty on Mr. Sharaa's head when he led a group affiliated with al-Qaeda. The United Nations Climate Change Summit, COP30, opens today in the Brazilian city of Belém. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has said he wants the talks to deliver concrete action on cutting greenhouse gases. The US has said it won't be sending any high-level delegates. The research from the charity Crisis suggests the number of homeless families in England last year was about 189,000 higher than the government statistics indicated. The charity says almost 300,000 families were rough sleeping or living in tents or cars or unsafe B&Bs. The government said it was investing more than £1 billion in homelessness services this year.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It is now 27 minutes to 7. What has happened? What is happening at the BBC? In normal times, you might be forgiven for dismissing that question as navel-gazing by journalists who can't resist talking about themselves. In normal times, I'd be inclined to agree with you. These, though, are not normal times. the boss of the organisation, which remains, despite all the rows about bias, the most trusted news organisation in this country, perhaps also across the globe, has quit, along with the head of news, after a row in which the President of the United States denounced what he called doctoring of what he'd said in a speech featured on a BBC Panorama programme. Ever since the first rumours of the resignation surfaced, I've been piecing together what happened which led to this crisis. Those at the top of the BBC have appeared paralysed for the past week, unable to agree what to say, not just about the editing of that speech, but also wider claims of institutional bias. One source described the arguments that have raged ever since The Telegraph published a leaked memo by a former advisor to the BBC board as, and I quote, like armed combat. Another alleged political interference after what they described as a hostile takeover of parts of the BBC. Now, the BBC is run by a board made up of the leaders, the managers, if you like, of the major divisions of the corporation, including news, and also part-time directors appointed by the government of the day. BBC News executives, the journalists who run the news division, agreed the wording of a statement at the beginning of last week, admitting that it had been a mistake to edit together two different sections of Donald Trump's speech on the day of the Capitol Hill riots without clearly signalling to the audience that that edit had been made. It would have concluded that despite this error, there was no intention to mislead the audience. This was not good enough for the BBC board, which refused to sign off the statement. The report it had received from Michael Prescott, an independent advisor to the BBC's Editorial Guidelines and Standards Board until June of this year, stated that the Panorama film had in fact created the impression that Trump said something he did not, and in doing so materially misled viewers. The argument which raged on the BBC board ensured that the BBC neither defended itself nor admitted its mistakes for day after long day after the leaking of the Prescott dossier alleging institutional bias. As criticism mounted from the White House, from former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and many others, the BBC merely said that it would not comment on leaked documents, whilst promising that the chairman of the BBC, Samir Shah, would respond in writing to MPs on the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee. In her resignation statement last night, the chief executive of BBC News, Deborah Turness, stated, "The ongoing controversy around the Panorama on President Trump has reached a stage where it is causing damage to the BBC, an institution that I love." Neither she nor the outgoing director general, Tim Davie, explained what they thought had actually gone wrong. A majority of the BBC board appear to agree with their editorial advisor that there is a problem of institutional bias reflected in that coverage, not just of Donald Trump, but of Gaza and Israel, and also the argument about trans rights. That argument has been led in particular by one board member, Sir Robbie Gibb, a former BBC executive in charge of political programmes, who became Prime Minister Theresa May's Downing Street Director of Communications, is one of those involved in the founding of GB News and a supporter of the Conservative Party. Friends of Sir Robbie insist he has repeatedly and consistently supported Tim Davie as Director General and wanted him to stay, and point out that he's written articles supporting the BBC in the licence fee. Now, as of last night, the consequence of this row was that the BBC board's 15 members had still not agreed the wording of the statement due to be made this morning by the chairman of the BBC, Samir Shah. We expect that letter to be published in the next few hours, but not while we are on air. A final thought, an intriguing one. I understand that at the time of the transmission of the Panorama film, back in October 2024, there were no complaints received about the editing of Donald Trump's speech. Let's turn now to our culture correspondent, who is following what's happened and what is about to happen, our culture reporter, Noor Nanji. Morning to you, Noor.
Morning.
Let's go to this issue of what we know and what we're still waiting to know. What explanation have we had so far as to why a row about a single edit on Panorama has claimed two such high-profile scalps, and what are we waiting for in this statement from Samir Shah?
Well, you're right for Tim Davey and for Deborah Ternas. I mean, it's hardly the first headline-making crisis that they've seen. But I think for Tim Davey, at least, it feels from reading his statement last night as if the cumulative effect of all those controversies means that he just basically didn't have enough oil in the tank for yet another fight. And Deborah Ternas also clearly said that the buck stopped with her after that Panorama edit. But I think for many as well, it's also been about how the BBC responded to all of this. Should they have done something sooner about the Panorama documentary? Why did it take a Telegraph report for it to all come to light? And should they have apologised sooner? And that does bring us on to today. And of course, the BBC chairman, Samir Shah, is due to report back to the Culture, Media and Sports Committee today. Hopefully the board have now agreed the wording. And he is also expected to offer an apology. Now, some will say, as I say, that should have come sooner. And indeed, if it had, maybe things would have been different. And we also don't know what the apology will involve, whether it's specifically around the editing of that Panorama documentary or more broadly around the issues facing the BBC, the wider issues.
Yeah, and it's those wider issues that obviously underlie this resignation or two resignations, a deeper argument about allegations of what's called BBC institutional bias.
That's right. And I mean, that was really in the spotlight yesterday. Again, we had the Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, talking about these claims of systemic bias. Now, that will be disputed. Deborah Ternas as well rejected that in her statement yesterday. But that scrutiny won't go away. And then you had the President of the United States, Donald Trump, castigating the BBC and calling BBC journalists corrupt. Now, of course, the BBC's defenders would say that the BBC puts out many hours, thousands of hours of output, and that mistakes will inevitably happen, and that these things should be seen in that context.
Oh, Nanji, thank you.
Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry.
Good morning.
So a wide range, as you would expect, of political responses to this news. Just tell us some of them.
Well, let's start with the government. Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary, has had a pretty testy relationship with Tim Davey, and she's been incredibly critical of him at various points. But actually, not this weekend. She was quite defensive of the BBC, as she happened to be on the broadcast shows, the political shows, yesterday, and I understand was as surprised as many of us in the afternoon to learn that Tim Davey was leaving the BBC. She said, "I want to thank Tim Davey for his service to public service broadcasting over many years. He has led the BBC through a period of significant change." Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the Conservative Party, said it was right that Tim Davey and Deborah Ternas had finally taken responsibility and resigned from the BBC, but she said there has been a catalogue of serious failures that runs far deeper. And worth saying that she talks about not just the Panorama edit, but some of the other issues raised by Michael Prescott, talks about BBC Arabic, which Kemi Badenoch says must be brought under urgent control, and also the BBC's coverage of women's rights and transgender issues. She says the corporation can no longer allow its output to be shaped by a cabal of ideological activists. Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, has been pretty critical of the BBC over its coverage of Reform UK. He said the BBC isn't perfect, but it remains one of the few institutions standing between our British values and a populist Trump-style takeover of our politics. Meanwhile, Nigel Farage told the Westminster Hour here on BBC Radio 4 that this appointment of a new Director General is the last chance for the BBC.
Mm. And on that point, Henry, it is an important moment. Looking just a little further into the distance, charter renewal, not too far away. This is obviously where the government, the Royal Charter, gives the BBC the ability to broadcast, to exist, and also sets the licence fee. And that was something that Tim Davey was working on. So his successor will take that on.
Yeah, and it will be such a big and immediate issue for his successor, because the charter, which sets out the terms of the BBC's operation, expires on the 31st of December 2027. And in sort of executive time horizons, that's pretty soon. And as you say, one of the things the charter does is set the funding model for the BBC, namely, at the moment, the licence fee. And I say at the moment because there are fundamental questions, not least being raised by Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary, about the licence fee's sustainability into the second quarter of the 21st century. And both sides, the BBC and the government, have been shaping up for this negotiation for some time, honing their arguments. Well, obviously, the government will now be waiting to see if the new leadership of the BBC comes to have a different perspective on what they want out of that negotiation. And all at a time when, as those quotes describe that I read out in my first answer to you, patience with the BBC in different parts of the political arena is wearing thin, perhaps like never before.
Thank you, Henry. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. As Nick was saying earlier, we will continue to look at this through the programme this morning. We will hear from the BBC's critics and from its supporters as well.
It's 16 minutes to seven. But as we know that patients can wear thin about the BBC talking about itself, there's plenty of other news. We're going to be talking in a second about the NHS, about homelessness. But let's begin with some other news. Coming from Belgium, important news, though, about the threat posed by Russia to members of NATO. Three drones have been detected above a nuclear power plant in Belgium, just hours after the head of Britain's armed forces told the BBC that Britain was willing to offer the country military support. Our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse, based in Brussels, can tell us more. Tell us more about those drone attacks.
Morning, Nick. Well, they are all connected, aren't they, these events? We have heard Sir Richard Knighton, the new Chief of Defence Staff, tell the BBC that he has agreed, at Brussels' request, to send a team of around 20 or 30 personnel with anti-drone equipment. We don't know whether that is those are jamming devices, whether they are providing the Belgians with the means to intercept drones. But this sighting above a nuclear power plant is the latest in a string where we have seen, and the footage is pretty grainy. It's very difficult to get a sense of scale from authorities, not just in Belgium, but in Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, where these small FPV drones have been spotted either over airports or military bases. And there is a growing consensus, notably in Western Europe, that, you know, this is infrastructure being targeted. We've had a suggestion from the German Defence Minister, Boris Pistorius, that, you know, Belgium's being targeted particularly because one of its financial institutions holds frozen Russian financial assets, which are being debated within the European Union as to whether they should be provided to Ukraine in the form of a financial loan. Amidst all of the finger-pointing, Nick, we have seen no public evidence that suggests that Russia is responsible, and the Kremlin, as it has done time after time, has denied being involved. However, we only need to look at the ongoing invasion of Ukraine by Moscow. We only need to look at more serious drone incursions or incursions by fighter jets over Estonia and Poland further east as to why they are fueling these pools of suspicion. But nevertheless, in a quite an unusual move, we now have the UK assisting an immediate neighbour over a threat still very much unknown.
James Waterhouse in Brussels. Thank you very much indeed.
It's 14 minutes to seven now.
That is the rather lovely sound of red kites. Red kites born in Spain, which were brought back here in order to make sure that red kites did not go extinct back in the 1990s. Well, now British-born red kite chicks are being used to return the favour to the Spanish to boost the bird population over there. We can talk to Head of Species and Land Management at RSPB Scotland, Duncan Orr Ewing. Morning to you, Duncan. How many of the little chicks are going over to Spain? Good morning to you, Duncan.
Good morning.
We lost you there briefly, Duncan. Tell us about these red kite chicks that you're sending to Spain. How many are heading in that direction?
We've sent 128 birds over the 4 years.
128 birds. And why do the Spanish need them? Have they got problems with their population there?
Yeah, so their population has been in steady decline in contrast to the UK's. And in fact, at the southern end of the range, the bird has become nearly extinct. The birds that came to England originally actually came from northwestern Spain in Navarra.
And do we send over just chicks or are we sending over mating pairs?
No, we send them over as chicks. They're collected at 4 weeks of age when they're basically nearly fully feathered and can also feed themselves. And then they're translocated over to Spain where they're kept in release aviaries and then released.
I remember my first sight of a red kite soaring over the Chilterns, gorgeous sight, but not everybody welcomes them, do they? Some regard them as a pest because they can steal food, they can even grab small pets.
Well, I don't think they can grab small pets, but they're definitely, we don't encourage people to feed the kites. There's plenty of natural food out there in the environment for these birds. At one point, I mean, if we go back to the Elizabethan period, the red kite was probably the commonest bird of prey at that stage, scavenging even on the streets of London. So they are and should be a numerous species.
But in certain areas, in certain countries, that's not the case. So you're delighted to return the favour, are you, to the Spanish?
Yeah, I mean, in 1989 and 1990, when the Spanish colleagues started donating red kites for our reintroduction programme in England, you know, they did us a huge favour, and it's great to be able to reciprocate.
Duncan Oyung of the RSPB in Scotland, thank you for joining us.
It's nearly 10 to 7. An independent inquiry into hundreds of children being misdiagnosed by NHS hearing test centres is published later today. Many of them were left with learning and communication problems after being told that their hearing was fine when it actually wasn't. While Dr Camilla Kingdon carried out the report, she is a consultant neonatologist at Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us a little, first of all, about when you looked into this, what you actually found.
Well, thank you very much for asking me on this morning. I was commissioned by the Secretary of State, Wes Streeting, to undertake a review to look at children's hearing services across England. And what I found was that a service which I think we historically and regularly consider to be a low-risk service, in other words, a hearing audiology programme that screens newborn babies and then refers babies that are found to have hearing impairment on to a more robust diagnostic process and then potentially treatment, has sailed under the radar, unfortunately, for many, many years, has been underfunded and undervalued. And so sadly, what we have learnt is that many children have been missed and that this, of course, has potentially lifelong consequences for children.
Yeah, and you identify that more than 300 children who are known to have been suffering long-term harm now because they were misdiagnosed. So what does the government and the NHS need to do to actually reverse this, to get this service back on track?
Well, what I've done is I've made a series of recommendations that I based on talking to over 100 audiologists and parents and policymakers, as well as working with the National Deaf Children's Society to really understand from families and parents what their experiences are like. And so the recommendations I've made cover everything from the way we train our audiology healthcare workforce, how we ensure that they are registered and are accessing good continuous professional development. I make recommendations around how we should be ramping up NHS England's recall and review programme to truly understand the extent of the problem at the moment. And then a raft of recommendations that can hopefully put this service on a much more confident and safe footing going forward.
Dr. Camilla Kingdon, thank you for telling us about it, who carried out that report. The Department of Health have a copy of it now. Obviously, they say that they are considering the recommendations to make sure that they get this right, they say, including looking at how to implement them effectively. They also say that the Health Secretary will publish a full response to those 12 recommendations that Dr. Kingdon has made in the new year.
It's now 7:08.
Now, let us talk about something which we all know about, but the figures tell a slightly different story. The homelessness charity Crisis says there were more homeless families in England last year than government statistics suggested, around 189,000 more. It says that is because of how the data is collected, which means many of them just don't make it into the official figures. Well, Isra Sulivani is a fourth-year medical student. She's working with Crisis as a lived experience campaigner. She came to the UK in 2009 with her family, who were refugees from the war in Iraq, and they spent time in and out of homelessness.
in one of the houses, there was a rat infestation with my sister. I remember her screaming in the middle of the night because she'd opened the toilet seat and a rat had popped out. Or a lot of the houses were extremely cold, to the point where anytime we'd have anyone over, which wasn't very often, like, our house was known as the cold house. Like, heating wouldn't work most of the time, or the windows would just be, I don't know, like single glaze, and that just contributed to a whole host of issues. Or a lot of the places that we were at weren't safe either. We were living at some point above somebody who blasts music until late at night, and we were in, there was a lot of us, like around four of us in one room at the time. I remember like sleeping on the floor, and because their music was playing so loud, like our heads were literally thumping with the music, and we couldn't open the windows, even though it was like a hot summer's day, because they were smoking weed, so opening it would just essentially fill the room with the smell of weed. I'd constantly be changing schools, that nothing was permanent, and me and my siblings kind of knew that this sort of stuff, you're really just at the hands and mercy of like the council, essentially. So when rent prices go up, our situation becomes a lot more unstable, but that's nothing, that's out of our hands, and we can't control that. Right now we're at a stable position, but that could definitely change at any point. It's not just my family, it's lots of families across the UK. It's just you don't see or hear about us because we're moving around so much.
As Isra describing there, just some of the difficulties, particularly for children, of being homeless. Matt Downey's with us, Chief Executive at Crisis. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why are these families not making it into those official figures on which so much is decided when it comes to policy and funding and all of those important things?
Well, we started collecting data in a different way quite a few years ago, because it was clear that the official data were actually a register of the supply of help that's available rather than the demand for that help. And if you look at the way the homelessness systems work across the country, you often see people who are just not allowed into homelessness assistance, so rough sleepers, various other people, who actually don't qualify. So what we wanted to do was to provide a comprehensive view of the full scale of homelessness, because unless you fully grasp the scale and the nature of this challenge, you can't possibly hope to end it.
Yeah. So how did you find then all of those extra families who were outside of the statistics?
Well, the experts at Heriot Watt University are the people that have done it. It's independent research, it's not us. And what they've done is they've effectively aggregated all the different sources of information that are out there in terms of the types of homelessness, the ways that people show up in statistics about, you know, sleeping in public transport, going around on buses, beds in sheds, hostels, night shelters, temporary accommodation, sofa surfing. We're not talking about nice forms of living here. This is the worst forms of homelessness. And we've reached a dreadful threshold, really, of 300,000 families and individuals homeless in England now. So something big needs to change. Otherwise, that number is going to go up.
Mm. And as we touched on, part of the problem is if the numbers aren't including everybody, then when funding is allocated for these things, when services are created, if they underestimate the need, then they just won't be able to deal with the number of people who need that help.
That's right. And we're helping around 10,000 people every year and more over the winter period. And almost all of those people will have been told by their council, there's nothing for you, or you don't qualify for support. And there are many other organisations like us around the country doing that. So that shows you what we've got here is a level of demand that, frankly, our support systems can't cope with. So unless you see a government plan to deal with the full causes of homelessness in the first place, you'll just see more and more people on our streets in temporary accommodation and in other forms of homelessness.
So what is your message to the people then who are making those decisions?
Well, we're told that there's the government strategy on homelessness is coming. And the message really is go big, be bold about this. You know, obviously we need to see a mass expansion in social housing so that people on low or no incomes have somewhere to live. And actually Rachel Reeves has got a chance in a few weeks to do something really necessary, which is to increase housing benefit, because when there's not enough social housing to go around, housing benefit is the thing that oils the wheels of keeping people out of homelessness or getting people into a home of their own. And housing benefit's been frozen for too long. So we need that, but we also need the causes of homelessness where people are coming out of government institutions like the care system, prisons, hospitals, the asylum and refugee system.
Yeah.
Homelessness is going up from within the government's own control on, you know, 20% plus a year rates.
So lots of elements to look at. Matt Downey, our Chief Executive at Crisis, thanks for joining us this morning.
2:07, time for the weather. Here's Simon.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning. Yes, we've got some pretty messy weather on the way for the next few days, and potentially quite heavy rain to come later on into the week. But this morning in southwest England and Wales, it's largely dry. We'll have a few bright spells, a bit of sunshine developing for a time, but some heavy showers starting to move their way into the Isles of Scilly, into West Cornwall at the moment. Those will spread their way further north and eastward. So some thunderous showers moving into all parts by lunchtime and through the afternoon, and temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, pretty cloudy this morning, some patchy rain around. That rain is going to clear away. Might be some limited brightness, but through the afternoon, some showers will move their way in. Those could be, again, quite heavy and thundery, temperatures of 12 to 14 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, some cloud this morning, some patchy rain across eastern areas. That's going to clear. Some sunny spells developing, but we will see some showers coming into parts of northwest England this afternoon, highs of 11 to 14 Celsius. For northern Ireland today, some rain most likely at times across northern parts this morning. Southern areas will be a little bit drier and brighter, highs of 9 or 10 Celsius. And across Scotland today, quite a chilly start, especially in the north with some clear skies, but heavy rain in central and southern Scotland this morning, spreading north and westward today. Some dry weather coming through across eastern areas of Scotland later, and top temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. Much more to come on the main stories of the day, so do stay with us. Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 10th of November. The main headlines this morning: the BBC chairman will address criticism of the way Panorama edited a Donald Trump speech after the director general and head of news both resigned. We'll ask why they chose to go now and hear why some people think there's been a political coup at the BBC. The US Senate has approved a deal that could end the federal government shutdown, and the COP30 climate change summit opens today in Brazil with no high-level American representatives present.
Also coming up in the next hour, the government plans to give 16-year-olds the vote at the next election. So how do they get their news and form their opinions? A new study begins to find the answers, and our cyber correspondent speaks to a hacker who spent almost 10 years on the FBI's most wanted list and is now in prison.
We didn't think about consequences. We wanted freedom, independence from our families.
What were you buying?
Beer, good clothes, expensive shoes, and I would show off the money at school.
That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
The BBC is facing calls to prioritise restoring trust with its audiences as it begins a search for a new Director General and Head of News. Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus announced their resignations yesterday evening after criticism of how a Panorama documentary edited a speech by President Trump. The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, is expected to address their departures today when he responds to concerns about editorial standards raised by a committee of MPs. Here's our media correspondent, David Sillitoe.
The original plan for today was that the BBC would merely provide answers to the Commons Media Select Committee about why a clip of a Donald Trump speech in a Panorama was spliced together from two separate sections, 54 minutes apart. But events have moved on, with not one but two resignations. Tim Davey, the Director General, said it wasn't the whole reason he'd chosen to go, but no one doubts it certainly determined the timing. The Chief Executive of News, Deborah Turnus, said the controversy around Panorama was causing damage to the BBC and mistakes had been made, but denied BBC News was institutionally biased. That issue had been raised by Michael Prescott, a former independent editorial adviser at the BBC whose concerns led to a series of stories in the papers. He will meet MPs later this week. The BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, said it was a difficult day for the BBC. What began as a series of questions about a Panorama has become a crisis, with the corporation now looking for candidates for its two biggest jobs.
The resignations of Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus have been welcomed by President Trump. Writing on social media last night, he said they were caught doctoring his speech, and he accused them of trying to step on the scales of a presidential election. With her analysis of where the episode leaves the BBC, here's our media editor, Katie Razzle.
On the face of it, Tim Davey's departure makes some sense. As his statement makes clear, the Director General had been under intense personal and professional pressure. As the controversies mounted, he didn't seem his usual buoyant self. My assessment is that he didn't have enough oil in the tank for another fight. The claims about Panorama and the edit of President Trump's speech were very damaging to the BBC. The corporation needed to get on the front foot and either apologise or defend itself. I understand a statement had been prepared days ago to apologise, but that was blocked by the board. I'm told there was outright hostility towards the CEO of News, Deborah Turness, in a crisis meeting on Thursday. It had decided a letter to the Culture, Media and Sport Committee was preferable. But for a week, claims about the BBC and editorial bias were allowed to fester. It's a moment of real crisis for the corporation, and there will be questions about who governs it.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, said the culture at the BBC needed overhauling from top to bottom. The leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, told the Westminster Hour here on Radio 4 that the BBC had to change to protect its future.
I frankly think a slimmed-down BBC that goes back to its Reithian principles and can be absolutely politically as neutral as it possibly can be. And if we have that, fine. My worry would be for the BBC, if we get the wrong Director General and this continues, then I would say this is the last chance for the BBC and you will see millions refusing to pay the licence fee.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, said the corporation needed to turn a new leaf, but a strong BBC was vital.
There are people on the right of British politics who are, you know, following Trump's America and don't believe in a free, independent press and a free, independent, strong BBC. Well, Liberal Democrats do. And yeah, we'll have our criticisms, but we'll defend it. We are deeply worried that we're seeing populism, right-wing populism, damaging our institutions like the BBC.
Some MPs are now calling for the government to bring forward its review of the BBC's charter. With his thoughts on how yesterday's resignations could shape the corporation's future, here's our political editor Chris Mason.
The size of the BBC and its funding model means it has always been, will always be, plenty say should always be, subject to the highest scrutiny. For politicians of every political persuasion, it is not just another organisation which they can be detached from or disinterested in. They will have a personal experience of it alongside any political view. The sharpest criticisms of the BBC historically and recently often but not always come from the right. What comes next for the government and whoever the BBC finds to lead it is a negotiation about its charter, which sets out its purpose, governance and funding. The current charter expires at the end of 2027. That conversation will take place against a backdrop of colossal change in the global media landscape. And plenty ponder how publicly funded and commercial UK-based media, providing news and wider programming, can survive, even thrive, when the internet in all its guises, streaming, social media, has upended so much.
The US Senate has approved a deal aimed at ending the government shutdown that's lasted nearly 6 weeks. Many government operations have ground to a halt and hundreds of thousands of federal workers have gone without pay. Anthony Zerker reports from Washington.
The longest government shutdown in U.S. history may not be over yet, but an end appears to be in sight. 8 Democrats in the 100-seat Senate joined all but one of the Republicans to approve a stopgap measure that will fund all government services until the end of January. In addition, a few government departments and programs, including low-income food aid, will be funded until October. Democrats had been demanding an extension of health insurance subsidies for tens of millions of Americans, but they made little progress, with Republicans only agreeing to put that to a vote in the Senate. The House of Representatives will also have to approve the funding bill before it can be sent to Donald Trump for his signature.
The Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, will have talks with President Trump today. The US once had a $10 million bounty on Mr. Sharaa's head when he led a group affiliated with al-Qaeda. He'll be the first Syrian leader to visit the White House since the country's independence nearly 80 years ago. The United Nations Climate Change Summit, COP30, opens today in the Brazilian city of Belém. For the first time, the US has said it won't be sending any high-level delegates. From Belém, our climate editor Justin Rowlett reports.
Donald Trump has made his priorities clear. His goal is American energy dominance, driven by an aggressive expansion of fossil fuel production. The agenda for this conference could not be more different. Brazil's President Lula da Silva says he wants these talks to deliver concrete action on cutting planet warming emissions and to reaffirm the power of multilateralism. Whether that vision can prevail over the wishes of individual governments will determine the success of this summit, as well as progress on tackling global warming.
Research from the charity Crisis suggests the number of homeless families in England last year was about 189,000 higher than government statistics indicated. The charity says almost 300,000 families were rough sleeping or living in tents or cars or unsafe B&Bs. The government said it was investing more than £1 billion in homelessness services this year. A new schools inspection system begins in England today. Overall judgments, such as good or requires improvement, have been scrapped. Instead, schools will be given one of five grades in several different categories. The changes have been introduced by Ofsted in response to the death of a head teacher, Ruth Perry, who took her own life after her school was downgraded.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. It's 9 minutes past seven. What has happened is a national disgrace, a victory for a cabal of toxic plotters who designed and executed a coup against the Director General of the BBC. Not my view, the incendiary claim being made this morning, and we'll hear why the man who made it thinks it in a moment. But we'll also hear a contrary view from the columnist and Conservative peer, Charles Lord Moore, the former editor of The Telegraph, the newspaper which published the leaked memo, which highlighted the rows that had been happening behind the scenes here at the BBC about allegations of institutional bias, and in particular, what Donald Trump has called the doctoring of the video of his speech in a panorama transmitted last year. So first, though, that claim of a coup. The claim comes from David Yelland, familiar voice on this programme, co-presenter of Radio 4's When It Hits the Fan podcast about crisis communication, a man with a long history in the business, a former editor of the Sun newspaper. Morning to you, David.
Morning, Nick.
You are already being attacked on social media, you'll know, for the claim of a coup. It's a hell of a claim. Why do you say it?
It was a coup, and worse than that, it was an inside job. There were people inside the BBC, very close to the board, very close to the, on the board, who have systematically undermined Tim Davey and his senior team over a period of, and this has been going on for a long time. What happened yesterday didn't just happen in isolation. I think it's important to understand that.
You are claiming, just to be clear, that both the Director General and the Head of News were forced out of their job by a group on the BBC board, not of managers, but of what we call non-executive directors, part-timers appointed by successive governments. For what reason do you claim?
What has happened here is there was a failure of governance. I don't blame the chairman, Samir, as an individual, but the job of the chair of any organisation, a company, or including the BBC, is to keep their CEO, their top man or woman, in post or fire them. And that has not happened because Tim Davey was not fired. He walked. And so there was, that is the definition of a failure of governance. I mean, Tim Davey, he will be re-employed quite quickly. And, you know, his future is very bright. It's the BBC that I'm concerned about. And by the way, he's going to be in today. He's not going for a period of months. And I'll tell you this, by the time he leaves this building, we will know what happened and his reputation will be very high. The reputation of lots of other people.
Forgive me, David, you're uncharacteristically hinting at something without quite spelling it out. And I do want to challenge your version, but only once I've understood it. When you talk of a coup, an inside job, people think, what's he talking about? Surely it was just a perfectly legitimate row on a board about editorial standards in which one group on the board believed that the management had made some mistakes but were doing their best, and another group on the board said, not nearly good enough. There's been far too many errors, far too many mistakes. We keep telling you about this. You keep failing to sort it out, and therefore we've had enough of you.
No, I understand that, and there is some truth in that. But one of the peculiar natures of my career is that although I'm sat here now in the Today programme studio, I spent two decades in the newspaper business, and I, as you know, and people know, I was editor of The Sun. I was very close to Rupert Murdoch. I've often been in rooms with, I know Michael Prescott, I know all these people extremely well, and I know how they think, and I know what they've been trying to do for a long time. And I myself, when I was editing The Sun wrote leaders saying the BBC should be closed down. I've got one of those in my downstairs loo framed, and I'm very sorry about that. It was a long time ago. What happened to me was that as I had been in New York for a long time, and when I came into the chair of editing The Sun, every person I met at the BBC, including yourself, Nick, I have to say, I was impressed with. And I began to compare my own organisation to the BBC. And I will say to the listeners and to anyone that's listening and interested in this, believe you me, there is a reason why the BBC is the most trusted news organisation in the world. And newspapers are not. And this is a victory. Look at who is celebrating this morning, including the President of the United States. You know, this is not a good day. And I do think there was a failure of governance. It may well be that the new chair came in and the structure wasn't right and he couldn't do anything about it. But we do need, I think the BBC needs to look very carefully at that. And
final thought, David, if I may. I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're saying, and Charles Moore will speak for himself in a second.
Yeah.
You, I think, are saying that the people on the board, you allege, carried out this coup, were not trying to make the BBC better. They were trying to nobble it. And you think some of those outside working with them, what, want to close it down or to bring it down to size?
Well, you know, you should ask them what they want. What do they want? Because I think in this country, we need and want a BBC to be as strong as possible. And they will attack, but they never actually say what they want. And I think that's a question for other people.
David Yelland, thank you very much indeed. No doubt hear more about this on When It Hits the Fan, the podcast about crisis communications.
Well, Charles Moore, Lord Moore, is a former editor of the Daily Telegraph, The Spectator and The Sunday Telegraph, still writes for them. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to ask you a little more about what David Yelland was saying, particularly in terms of there being a coup potentially run from within. But before I do, I'm keen to try and understand what your position is now on the BBC, because in the past you have chosen not to pay the licence fee. You were fined for that back in 2010, but you were also mooted as a potential chairman yourself at one point. So do you believe in the BBC? Do you believe the BBC is a good thing, a necessary thing for the UK?
I think the absolutely key thing about the BBC for its survival and why it matters is its impartiality. And that is what Tim Davey announced when he became Director General he would try to enforce, and which he didn't succeed in enforcing, and therefore he's gone. And if I may say so, I think that the way this has been covered this morning shows the problem you collectively have, which is that you're already trying to accuse people of coups and that sort of thing, rather than tell the listeners what this report, this internal memo said, and how serious the accusations in it are.
But with respect, Lord Moore, you're here doing exactly that.
No, because you're already asking me about coups and that sort of thing.
No, I was asking you where you stand on the BBC before we talk about coups. I think that's really important for our listeners.
This should be good for the BBC because it should really make them respect the idea of diversity of opinion and impartiality in their coverage. And what the internal memo shows is Nick Robinson, I think, tried to turn this into a thing about how Trump is threatening the BBC. There's actually only one thing about Trump in this, by far, which is important, but it's only one. By far the biggest thing in the internal memo is about the coverage of the Israel-Gaza. And this shows the most extraordinary degree of systemic bias, particularly in BBC Arabic, which on the day of the attack, October the 7th, the English language version on the website carried 19 stories about the taking of hostages. BBC Arabic carried none. And they interviewed, there's a man, for example, called Sama El-Zayanen, who regularly used, who said that Jews should be burned as Hitler did. And he's appeared 244 times between November 23 and April 25 on BBC Arabic. By the way, Anna, the day of Tim Davies' resignation was in fact the same day as the Kristallnacht atrocities in 1938. And on Kristallnacht, it's often said that the figure is given, it may not be quite accurate, that 91 people, Jews, were killed that day by the Nazis. In October the 7th, well over 10 times that number were killed. And yet it turns out that the BBC has been repeatedly using Hamas, who believe in the murder of Jews and who are... What would you say? What do you think if a BBC station or a series of programmes employed Nazis? But here is an absolutely massive problem, never addressed, never even admitted.
So, Lord Moore, let me...
This is the scale of the problem.
Let me ask you, if I may, do you think that now we've had the resignations of the Director General and of the Head of News, do you think the BBC is in a better and more positive place this morning than it was yesterday morning?
Well, I'm sure it isn't this morning because you're all at sixes and sevens, and as Nick Robinson showed, you're still trying to blame it on others and suggest coups and plots. But ultimately, this will be better. Or if it isn't better, that really is the end of the BBC, because now you have the chance to take impartiality seriously. I'm a BBC lifer as a listener, not as a participant. And I have always loved and respected the BBC's concentration on giving you impartial news. But the fact is, since the 1960s, when I was a boy, since then, it's unfortunately got very, very much worse.
So what do you think it should look like is what I'm trying to get to. I'm really keen to know, and I do want to ask you about coups as well, but I'm really keen to know what you think the BBC should look like.
Well, if you think it needs to admit, first thing you have to do is admit you're wrong instead of trying to defend yourself in this ridiculous way. All the BBC's bias goes in one direction. It could go much, much further, but it's about trans issues, identity, race, Trump, Israel, Gaza. It doesn't include climate, Brexit, the way they cover Black Lives Matter, all sorts of things like this. And it's always from a sort of metropolitan left position. Absolutely consistently, that's how the bias is. So that means that it's not serving a very, very large percentage of the licence fee payers. I'm not, of course, saying that it should be right-wing either. I'm saying it should take impartiality seriously and put in people capable of running this gigantic and self-satisfied bureaucracy.
Lord Moore, Charles Moore, thank you very much for joining us. We did say, didn't we, earlier on in the programme, that we would hear both from supporters and from critics of the BBC this morning. We will continue to do that between now and nine as we cover this story for you.
Incidentally, the reason I focus with David Elland on Donald Trump and the edit is that is the reason that was being given by the Director General and the Head of News for the decisions they took last night. But Lord Moore is, of course, right. And you can read the whole of Michael Prescott's memo on the Telegraph website. I don't know if it's also on the BBC, but it's certainly on the Telegraph website in detail, in which he details a whole series of arguments, really, that's what's clear, between BBC managers and those who are supervising them on the BBC board about alleged mistakes and about alleged bias on that full range of issues that Charles Moore, Lord Moore, has just described. Let's move on to other stories, though, before we return later in the programme to the BBC and what its future is. Will is back here in the studio talking about something called Applied Nutrition, which is a Liverpool-based protein powder and supplements firm, one of the biggest listings on the London Stock Exchange last year, and is today releasing its first full-year financial
report. Yeah, Nick, regular listeners might remember we talked about this company quite a bit because they were seen as a big bright light for the LSE last year at a time where we talked a lot on the programme, obviously, about a shortage of companies choosing to float their shares on the London Stock Exchange. As you say, results for the full financial year to July just released, and Tom Rinder, the founder and chief executive of Applied Nutrition, is with us this morning. Tom, morning.
Morning, Will.
And it looks like a strong set of results glancing across them. Big rise in revenue and profit.
Yeah, well, it's been a milestone year for Applied Nutrition. We've delivered strong, profitable growth over and above what market expectation, whilst maintaining a strong, disciplined margin. We've expanded globally with key retailers and new partners. And I think undoubtedly we've strengthened our position as a brand to be trusted.
And what is driving that? For people who don't know about some of your products, I mean, we're talking about sort of protein powders, aren't we? Supplements that people take when they go to the gym and things like that. That seems to be, it's not just you in that space doing well. So what is driving that, do you think?
You know, Will, health and wellness as a whole is trending. People are just more health conscious now and they want to make a healthier choice.
Yeah, and that's
and
your...
supplementation and sports nutrition and health and wellness products that plays a huge role within them healthier choices that people are making.
And what's your next steps then as a company?
We're just going to continue doing what we do, continue growing, continue innovating. Innovation is the heart of applied nutrition. New product development is something that we absolutely strive for.
And a new HQ here as well, I see.
We're building a new HQ, yeah. We're investing for the future. We're building a new headquarters very, very close to where we are now. We're also building phase three production, which is very exciting. That's going to see more automation, increase our capacity, and bring in some manufacturing capabilities that we currently outsource.
Well, Tom, thanks so much for your time this morning. Tom Ryder, the founder and chief executive of Applied Nutrition. And just another bit of big news from the city, Nick and Anna. The former Tesco chief executive, Sir Dave Lewis, has been named the new boss at Diageo, maker of Guinness. And Johnny Walker, been a long old search for that. Their chief executive left in the summer, Deborah Crew, after just 2 years in charge. Bit of a turnaround. The shares have fell to a 10-year low last week, so quite a bit of work on. But Sir Dave Lewis, a well-known name across the city, is going to take over from the 1st of January at Diageo.
Thank you, Will. It is, it's just coming around to 24 minutes past seven. Now, a cyber criminal who spent almost 10 years on the FBI's most wanted list has been speaking to the BBC in an exclusive interview from prison. Vyacheslav Penchikov, who's known as Tank, was the leader of two separate hacking gangs accused of stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from people right around the world. And the BBC's cyber correspondent, Joe Tide, he spent 6 hours with him in prison in Colorado in the US for a new podcast from the World Service, which is called Cyber Hack Evil Core. Here is just one clip of that interview with Tank, where he talks about the time when he was starting out as a hacker. And his words here are spoken by a producer.
We set up fake websites selling fake goods, then used stolen credit card details to buy those products from ourselves. The credit card companies would pay out like it was a real sale. It was a popular trick.
Did you ever feel guilty?
We didn't think about consequences. We wanted freedom, independence from our families.
What were you buying?
Beer, good clothes, expensive shoes. And I would show off the money at school. What teenager doesn't like to brag about? I was changing cars like changing clothes.
How many did you have?
At one point, I had six. All expensive German ones.
Well, Joe Tidy, the BBC's cyber correspondent, is with us. Morning, Joe.
Morning.
This is fascinating stuff. And as we said there, just the logistics of it in themselves are interesting, because you did that interview in prison.
Yes, and as you say, that's voiced up by a producer, because they wouldn't let us record anything inside the prison, unfortunately. But myself and a producer went there, and he was very open. He gave us, across 2 days, 3 hours of interviews, so 6 hours in total. We sat there with a pen and paper, just writing down everything he said, because this man was at the top of two different gangs across two different very distinct periods of cybercrime. He was part of the early banking Trojan, so the late 2010s, where they were stealing money directly from lots and lots of victims around the world. In about 3 months in the UK, they stole from 600 victims about 4 million quid. So small amounts, thousands and tens of thousands. That gang was called the Jabazoos crew. And then he had this sort of period where he tried to go straight, but then he got back into cybercrime in about 2019. And he got into ransomware, which of course is the most pernicious and problematic form of cyber attack of our modern times. The kind of attacks that have taken down and hacked M&S and Co-op, and we think Jaguar Land Rover as well. So he had really interesting insights on this kind of evolution of cybercrime.
And all of this is really important, because the number of times you've been on this programme talking about cybercrime, about hacking, often of large corporations, which has a real impact. So understanding this mindset it's obviously entertaining, but it is really useful as well.
It is. And it is so hard to get these people to talk, because, of course, it's so hard to catch them in the first place. They normally kind of retire with their millions to the Black Sea or somewhere like that. But he wanted to talk, and he had some very interesting insights. In my sort of 10 years of covering cybercrime, I've never had such a high profile, high level cyber criminal talk to me. And there was some really interesting insights. So, for example, this idea of the evolution of cybercrime. Back in those days when he started, everything was so easy. There was no cybersecurity. Banks didn't know what was going on. Police couldn't keep up. And then you see this kind of change where the security gets better, and the cyber criminals having to work a lot harder. And now, of course, it's all about ransomware. And he talks about this shift of going from lots of different victims to bigger. They call it big game hunting, where they go after one large multinational corporation. And instead of getting tens of thousands, they're getting millions now.
Joe, thank you for telling us about it. Really appreciate it. Joe Tidy, the BBC cyber correspondent. And you can listen to that whole podcast series. As I said, it's called Cyberhack Evil Core. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find it. Or there are episodes available a week early on BBC Sounds.
Meanwhile, Mike at 28 minutes past seven is here with the sports news.
Nick, thank you. Liverpool's mini revival stalled yesterday. The Premier League champions were soundly beaten 3-0 by Manchester City, who move up to second in the table. More on that in the next hour of the programme. There were also wins yesterday for Aston Villa, Nottingham Forest and Brentford, whilst leaders Hearts dropped more points in the Scottish Premiership. They drew 1-1 with Dundee United, which meant Celtic, who were 4-0 winners over Kilmarnock, closed the gap to 7 points with a game in hand. Whilst in Brazil, Lando Norris took another step towards winning a first Formula One World Championship title with a victory at the Sao Paulo Grand Prix. He's now 24 points ahead of his McLaren teammate and title rival Oscar Piastri with 3 races to go. We now, though, are going to talk rugby union because the second round of autumn internationals concluded yesterday with an all-too-familiar story in Cardiff.
At the end, despite the Welsh efforts, it's been a comprehensive victory for the Pumas. 7 tries for Argentina, but unfortunately, it's the same story we've had with Wales not having tasted victory at their home here at the Principality Stadium for over 2 years now.
Yes, the wait goes on. Wales 28, Argentina 52, the final score yesterday. Correspondent Chris Jones joins us to reflect on that and the rest of the weekend's action. Morning, Chris.
Mike, how's it going?
Yeah, OK. So a 19th defeat in 20 matches for Wales and a real baptism of fire for their new head coach, Steve Tandy.
Yeah, I don't think Tandy was under any illusions when he took the job about the size of the task he had to try and deal with Wales, and this would have been a reminder of it. Look, Wales played some good stuff. They scored some nice tries. With the ball in hand, they were bright, but they're chronically under strength, they're chronically underpowered, and they've shipped 50 points this weekend to go with 60 points when they last were at home against England in March. So the issues are clear, and given what is going on in Welsh rugby, it is definitely not going to be an overnight fix, and I think yesterday would have just told Tandy what he already knew.
Japan next up for Wales next week. You think they would really be targeting victory there with New Zealand and South Africa coming up after that. Meanwhile, Chris, contrasting fortunes over at Twickenham. A victory over Fiji on Saturday makes it 9 victories in a row for England.
Yeah, England's in a good spot. And you mentioned New Zealand there. They battled past Scotland. What a game that was. How disappointing for Scotland. How much Scotland fans, players and everyone be feeling. What another opportunity missed against the All Blacks in Edinburgh. But New Zealand now roll into London and they're on for a Grand Slam tour. They're 2-from-2, haven't beaten Ireland and beaten Scotland. And they play, as you say, an England team in a very good spot. They've won 9 in a row. Steve Borthwick's in that enviable position for a head coach. He's able to rotate and build his depth while also getting the job done and getting wins. But this is the game that defines England's autumn, doesn't it? They've had some tight losses against New Zealand over the past 18 months or so, and England fans will feel this is the Saturday to rectify that.
And you just did mention Scotland briefly. A word on them. We gave them the big build-up on Saturday morning on this programme, yes, saying, was this the day that they were going to make history with a first-ever victory over the All Blacks? They did come back, didn't they, from 17-0 down, but in the end, just not to be.
Yeah, the hope that kills. And it will be a familiar tale for Scotland fans, sadly. 17-0 down, and they got themselves back into the game magnificently. Had a chance to score in the corner, wasn't quite to be, but that's kind of been the tale of the tape for Scotland New Zealand games. If only they've got to dust themselves off. They've got a big game against Argentina to come. Scotland, they've got to make sure that they use these experiences of going close against the top teams when they go into the Six Nations in a few months' time.
Chris Jones, many thanks for rounding up all of the rugby union and the autumn internationals, as we say, continue this weekend as well. Some big games coming up.
Thank you, Mike. Here is what's coming up this week on Radio 4.
What makes a good dad?
Being there is such a benchmark, isn't it? You're there at the crucial moments. You're in it.
I'm the comedian Darren Harriott. As Radio 4 explores fatherhood, I'm looking at what it really means to be a dad.
He always loved you. It wasn't bad.
From my own dad, who died in prison when I was just 11, to a joyous first-time parent.
My whole universe has changed. It's so much better than I ever thought it would ever be.
So maybe by the end, I'll know if I want to be a dad myself. Father Figuring on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45.
Time for a quick look at the weather. Unsettled with spells of rain for many today. Sunny spells in the northeast and southwest at times.
Coming up in the next hour of the programme, 16 and 17-year-olds will be able to vote by the time the next general election comes around. So we will be looking at how they think.
And you are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. And at, 27 minutes to 8, Alan Smith has got a summary of the news.
The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, will address the resignations of the corporation's director-general, Tim Davey, and head of news, Deborah Turnus, when he responds today to concerns about editorial standards raised by a committee of MPs. Mr Davey and Ms Turnus said yesterday evening they were stepping down after criticism of the way a Panorama documentary edited a speech by President Trump. Mr Trump welcomed the resignations, saying there had been an attempt to step on the scales of a presidential election. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, called for a top-to-bottom overhaul of the corporation. The Radio 4 presenter and former editor of The Sun, David Yellen, told us the resignations had been a coup led by people inside the BBC. The former editor of The Telegraph, Lord Moore, said it was time the corporation took impartiality seriously. US senators have approved a deal which could bring an end to the longest government shutdown in American history. The breakthrough came after 8 Democratic senators agreed to support a stopgap measure put forward by Republicans to extend government funding until the end of January. The legislation now has to be passed by the House of Representatives. The Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, will have talks with President Trump today. The US once had a $10 million bounty on Mr. Sharaa's head when he led a group affiliated with al-Qaeda. The United Nations Climate Change Summit, COP30, opens today in the Brazilian city of Belém. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has said he wants the talks to deliver concrete action on cutting greenhouse gases. The US has said it won't be sending any high-level delegates. And a new schools inspection system is being introduced in England today. Ofsted will grade schools in several different categories, scrapping judgments such as good or requires improvement.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It's 26 minutes to 8 now. What can be done now to restore the BBC's reputation, to rebuild trust at a time of deep divisions in society, not just about politics, but about culture as well? Should the BBC's chairman accept the criticisms levelled in that memo sent to its board and leaked to The Telegraph last week? Allegations not just of a misleading television edit of Donald Trump speaking, but also of what was alleged to be wider institutional bias, bias against Israel, bias in favour of trans rights, for example. Or should Samir Shah listen to those inside the BBC management who've been warning him that his board has been hijacked by those with a political agenda supported by right-wing newspapers and by some on the right of British politics? Well, a man who is used to dealing with this on both sides of the divide joins us in the studio this morning. Sir Craig Oliver was editor of the BBC's 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news, but is no BBC lifer. He was at ITV News before that. He went to the other side to be director of communications at number 10 Downing Street under David Cameron, and also helped to lead the Remain campaign in the Brexit referendum. So, Craig, thank you for joining us.
Good morning
to you. Let's begin by why anyone other than the people in this studio and in this building should care. Does this really matter for people who've got busy lives and busy days and are worrying about paying the bills and getting to work this morning?
I think it does matter, and the BBC is an enormous institution with a huge impact on British life. I think it's got a role in a deeply polarised society to basically hold the ring and try to be impartial and be an institution that can do that. What I think has gone wrong here, I think, is really an issue of the governance of the institution. We're living in a fast-moving digital world where there are a lot of people who want to attack the BBC, and what we've seen is really a vacuum that has been created. It's been obvious for days now that the BBC needed to step up, explain, apologise, move on. And what we've seen is the governance of the BBC saying, we'll get back to you on Monday. We'll leave that for days. We'll allow the President of the United States to be attacking the institution, and we're not going to properly defend it.
Now, when you say it's a problem with the governance, wasn't that simply a reflection of a mighty great row at the top of the organisation? News executives defending their decisions on these various issues, while members of the board saying, not nearly good enough, you need not just to apologise for one television edit, you need to admit that there is a huge institutional problem.
That is precisely the moment where there needs to be muscular governance of the BBC and where the chairman needs to step in and say, look, we cannot allow days to pass where a vacuum is created and the story is metastasizing and growing. And as a result of that, we've not only lost the director general, we've lost the CEO of BBC News. And the institution is this morning in chaos, rudderless and leaderless because this situation has been allowed to get completely out of hand.
So when you say a problem of governance, let's be clear. Are you saying there's a structural problem that needs to be resolved? Or frankly, the man at the top of the BBC, the chairman, the man appointed, as it were, on behalf of licensed fee payers, hasn't been doing his job properly?
The job of the chairman of the governors of the BBC is at moments of crisis to step in and knock heads together and say, look, my job is to ultimately protect the BBC. Now, that may mean sacking people. It may be admitting mistakes and sacking and apologising. But it is also my job to step in. It is clear that he has not done that properly because we've got to a situation where we do not know what the BBC's explanation of this is, even after the resignation of the Director General and the BBC CEO of News.
Let's go to the substance, as it were, because Charles Moore, Lord Moore, you may have heard him earlier, says, well, hold on, stop talking about governance and coups and structures and processes. Talk about what this leaked memo revealed. And what he says it reveals is something that he and other people largely, but by no means exclusively on the right of politics, have said for a long time. There's a sort of institutional liberal metropolitan bias in favour of the conventional wisdom of the day. And declaration of interest, you shouted at me quite a few times when you were at Downing Street, even though we're ex-colleagues, and said, I find what you're reporting infuriating and enraging. Hasn't the essence of this, isn't the essence about standards that aren't good enough?
The BBC used to drive me crazy sometimes, and it's not an institution that has not got problems, I would say. But I think that what Charles Moore needs to do is get a bit of perspective here. It's easy to take a number of incidents that have happened over a period of time and string them together and present them as a narrative. You magnify and amplify them and say, look, see, here I can tell you a story that looks like bias. In reality, the BBC has huge amounts of output. It is gargantuan. Daily, radio, television, online, social media. It is constantly putting material out there. The issue here is when it makes mistakes, and it will make mistakes, as all journalistic institutions do, is does it step up? And does the person who is responsible for ultimately protecting the BBC step in and do something? The problem that he has now got is a question of viability of the BBC. Previously, in the run-up to the charter being renewed, it was all about the structure of the BBC funding. It is now a political football where the very viability of the BBC is in question, and he has questions to answer about that.
Let's be clear what you mean by viability. You mean that the consensus that there has been across parties, across society, for having a publicly funded, in inverted commas, impartial. We know there's a debate about what that means and whether it's delivered. You think that may break down? In other words, we could, if this is handled badly from now on, we could see the end of the BBC as we know it.
The BBC has always been contentious, and there have been crisis moments where it has fallen out with governments and politicians. It is now politically in play. It is an issue not just in the run-up to the charter, but to the next general election. Politicians will be actively campaigning on the structure of the BBC, what it is and isn't allowed to do, and how it should behave. Previously, there had been a consensus. That has broken down, and at that moment, it is the job of the person who is here to protect this institution, sometimes by admitting mistakes, sometimes by apologising, to step in and say, I am going to make decisions which are going to get a grip on this situation. That has not happened. We still do not know what the BBC's story is around what happened here.
Final question. I said on Saturday when reviewing the newspapers that as well as genuine stories about genuine worries about mistakes and standards, there was also politics going on here from people who wanted, to use the word I used then, to destroy the organisation. Lots of people reacted and said, nonsense, that's a defensiveness from someone who works for the institution. Do you believe there are people who want to destroy the BBC as against improve it?
I think there are people who would like the BBC to have what they perceive to be less power than it does. I found when I was in government was that the BBC was by a factor of 10 the most important institution journalistically. And if the BBC was getting something wrong or was chasing down a certain road, that was a huge problem for me to deal with. So, look, there is a question of scale here, which I think a lot of people are worried about. But I do think that there are political parties now who would like to get the BBC in hand and neuter it, yes.
Sir Greg Oliver, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 18 minutes to 8. Syria's President Ahmed al-Shirai is in Washington, D.C. today to meet President Trump. And this is a big moment. It brings him firmly in from a former al-Qaeda-linked fighter who was leading a group, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, that was proscribed in many countries around the world. He is now firmly in the international diplomatic fold. And when he ousted Bashar al-Assad nearly a year ago, he promised to be a president for all Syrians. But the country's minority communities have seen a string of sectarian killings, there have been revenge attacks, and there are people who fear that those big promises that he made will not be lived up to. Our senior international correspondent, Ola Guerin, reports from Homs province in western Syria.
I'm in an area called Wadi Nasara, the Valley of the Christians, about 3 hours' drive from Damascus. Right in front of me, there is a white cross with a wreath marking the scene of a deadly attack. There is blood still on the ground. Two Christian men were killed here, Wissam and Shafiq. They were cousins. They were sitting in the evening having a chat with a friend. A gunman arrived on a motorbike coming from the direction of the nearest Sunni village and opened fire.
This was the hail of bullets that killed Wissam and Shafiq Mansour, recorded on CCTV. Their friend was shot in the hand but escaped in the chaos, breaking his ankle as he fled. He agreed to speak to us but fears for his safety. We are not using his voice. His words are spoken by a producer.
To this day, I don't believe what's happened. It still feels like a dream. When the regime fell, we all came back to Syria. We wanted to start new businesses, but there is no security. My dearest friends are dead. I will have to leave the country again. There are many extremist and hardline groups. I don't know where Syria is going.
Many in the valley are now feeling vulnerable. Before the regime fell, they backed Assad, as many Christians did, and he backed them. Wissam was part of a local pro-Assad militia. Some here say that's why he was targeted.
The two bodies have been brought through the streets to the church, and prayers are now being said. The crowds are so big that people are standing outside. There is a deep sense in this village of loss and grief and anger. And many here have questions. They're asking if their community will be targeted again and what the future is for them in the new Syria.
Less than an hour's drive away, we found another community in fear, Alawites, the sect of Bashar al-Assad. In the old days, that could bring benefits. Now, it's a curse. Alawites are the main targets for revenge killings.
I'm in a family home in the city of Homs, and there's a very large framed photograph showing a girl with long, dark hair. Beautiful, smiling photograph. This girl was 14 years old and she was killed recently. I'm with her mum. Could I ask you to tell me what happened?
We were on the balcony at around 11 at night with some neighbours. My daughter had done well in her exams and we were celebrating. Suddenly a motorbike passed by and there was a lot of shooting. She tried to run into the house but couldn't make it. She'd been shot in the chest and died in my arms. She was the best of daughters.
Do you feel that you were targeted because your family are Alawite?
Yes.
Have you had any follow-up from the police or security services?
Nothing. They never came back with any results.
I'm standing in front of a supermarket. The shutters are down, and pinned to the front, there's a death notice for Shaban Ezzedine. This was his shop, the place where he worked all his life, and where he was shot dead as he closed up at night. His brother Adnan says Shaban never harmed anyone, but being an Alawite in the new Syria can be a death sentence. Was this kind of violence something you feared when Assad was toppled? Did you fear that the community would be targeted?
Yes, of course. They have been chanting sectarian slogans since the revolution began in 2011. They used to shout, "Alawites to the coffins, Christians to Beirut." What's happening right now is the seed of forced immigration. It's just the beginning. I lost my brother, others lost their loved ones. If we are all going to get killed, it's better we flee.
Thoughts there of Adnan El-Ezzedine, a bereaved Alawite man from Homs province in Syria, ending that report from our senior international correspondent, Ola Guerin.
It's 12 minutes to 8 now, and it is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker with us in the studio this morning is the Reverend Lucy Winkett, rector of St James's Piccadilly. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning. How do wars end? When a war is being fought, all that anyone can think about is when it will be over. In contrast to the wars of previous centuries where two opposing armies would arrive at a field to fight, in modern wars, so-called non-combatant civilians are often the main casualties in that terrible phrase, collateral damage. For a bombed civilian population, an overwhelming longing is all-consuming for the nightly peril and noise to cease, to get some sleep and comfort your children. But how do wars end? This question might sound like a high subject, by which I mean a mixture of military theory, political will and tactical assessment, and it can seem either long ago or far away or over there. But the fighting and ending of a war is a human endeavour that's much more ordinary than we think. To end a war requires not just exercising compassion for exhausted people, but also facing hard truths that not everyone wants peace. That for some leaders, governments, groups and gangs, war is a choice and its length a matter of their will. It means assessing the balance between justice, deterrent and revenge. Ending a war also requires facing the unanswerable question as the casualty lists grow. Did they die in vain? Today, we're between two silences. Yesterday, on Remembrance Sunday, in towns and villages across the UK, people of all generations and backgrounds gathered at war memorials to keep silence, to pray and remember. And tomorrow, Armistice Day, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, silence will be kept again. In those silences, in those prayers, we have a chance to see again that it's human beings who make war, and it's human beings who can choose at any moment on any day to start to broker peace. The Christian tradition allows that in very limited circumstances, the confrontation of evil acts and unjust rulers can lead to war, but also teaches that whether a truce comes with victory, negotiation, or a stalemated mutual exhaustion, the ending of war grows in the earth of ordinary day-to-day peacemaking about which every one of us has choices every day. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn, we say. Which reminds us that there are those of us who do have the years, and confronts us with the question, what will we do with the years they did not have? Will we prolong conflict in the pursuit of victory or chasing revenge? Or will we take the first step in our families, in our communities, in our neighbourhoods and nation to choose to make and keep peace?
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett. It is now 9 minutes to eight.
What does the mind of a 16-year-old look like? More than 700 of them across the country have been asked their thoughts on everything from the media, politics, right through to the state of the country. The cross-party think tank Demos has done this because they say it's time to, well, to really rethink how we engage with those people who will be voting for the first time at the next election. Peter Hyman is a former head teacher, former political advisor and co-author of the report. And Ava Santina is from Politics Joe. They make political content for younger audiences on social media. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Peter, first of all, what did you find in this report that surprised you or that made you think?
Well, to start with, I think this report in a way is almost like a vaccine shot against moral panic. So what we found was not all the sort of blaring headlines of Andrew Tate's corrupting all young people and they're all going to the far right and all the rest of it. We found very thoughtful, very sophisticated young people who are trying and often succeeding to navigate this online world. And we found, if you like, as a rule of thumb, three categories that are useful to have in our head of online content. One is healthy, one is hyper, and one is harmful. The healthy is stuff that is really enriching and teaches young people stuff. The hyper is like the sort of fitness, maximizing your fitness, which can go either way, can turn toxic. And the harmful is stuff like the sort of incredibly easy access now to things like porn online. But if you've got those three H's in mind, you don't immediately descend into this panic that we've seen so much in the headlines recently that young people are just sort of going off the rails.
Mm. And Ava, what you do with Politics Joe, I mean, going back a few years now, I used to work for Newsbeat, which makes the news for Radio 1, so younger audience. And actually it's some of the most important, but also some of the most complex journalism to do. People think that journalism for younger people is easy, but actually it's really hard to explain to people how things work at the grassroots, why they need to engage. And it's an important time to sort of catch them, isn't it? To teach them these things.
Yeah, and I tell you who's done that really well, actually, is Donald Trump. And you saw that through the various podcasts that he went on during the election. So you saw him appearing on shows like Joe Rogan and Theo Von. And that was a way to really ingratiate himself with young people. And that was a way to get onto their timelines indirectly on social media. And then that translated into them watching long-form interviews with him, sometimes for up to 2 or 3 hours. And actually, the retention rate for that is normally the entire interview, which is quite surprising for someone who's 16, 17 years old. And what you're seeing over in the UK is there's been a rise in interest in young people for the Green Party or for the Reform Party, because Nigel Farage and Zach Polanski have done that really well. They've really utilised social media as well as doing traditional linear broadcast. And actually in classrooms now around the country, those are the two politicians that young people are talking about.
Mm. So when you're doing your work, Ava, how do you balance appealing to the things that they want to know about while also providing that broad sweep of different topics as well?
So we never oversimplify the topics. We always just pick topics that we know are interesting to young people. So we've seen the war in Gaza has really peaked interest between 16 to 20 years old, also the economy. So it'd be quite surprising, actually, the sort of economists that a young person will sit down and watch an hour-long interview, like Varis Varoufakis, for example, is really popular amongst 18 and 19-year-olds. And you think, that's the former Greek finance minister. Mm. Like, what on earth is a 16-year-old watching that for? And actually, you find the engagement rate for them on a long-form piece that doesn't patronise or oversimplify the content is more popular than, say, an explainer video that might oversimplify.
That's really interesting. So, Peter, how should, I suppose, politicians in particular, because the particular focus of this is the fact that 16-year-olds will be voting in the future. How does that then translate into the essence of what politicians and political parties need to do to engage at that age?
Yeah, well, as Ava says, you've got to have something to say. You've got to have a strong message. Young people don't want something superficial. I think sometimes politicians think they just want something really boiled down. They want something with passion. They want to be listened to. What was striking going around the country properly listening is young people don't think they're listened to at all. So to give you one example, the issue that came up everywhere we went was knife crime. And yet they don't think politicians are really gripping that in a way that they think they would if it was for a different age group. Mental health is another big issue. Cost of living, of course, is. And they don't think there's an agenda being shaped for them. They hear the whole time about the triple lock for older people and for pensioners, but they don't hear what the agenda is for young people.
So that's what they're after. Does that feel different to the times when you were advising writing speeches for Tony Blair, for example, or for Keir Starmer? Do you feel that there is a shift in what they're expecting, what young people are expecting to hear from politicians?
Yes, and they want to cut through the crap, as it were. They want people engaging with them. They want people who are listening properly. They want authenticity. They want people who are not trying too hard to communicate with young people, but being who they are. Ava gave some good examples of that, of people who are just up front, who are speaking plainly. It was quite instructive that a lot of the young people, whilst they didn't particularly like Trump or Farage, were saying, well, at least they're telling it to me straight. At least it's not just sort of the normal waffle. We're getting a clear sense of what they want to do. And I think the mainstream politicians are often lagging behind on this. Mm.
That's really fascinating. Thank you both. Peter Hyman, who's the co-author of that report, and Ava Santina, who's from Politics Joe.
Let's talk now about what's coming up on Radio 4 this evening. Series 84 of A Classic Comedy.
On BBC Radio 4.
Canapes, the Brummy name for tinned peas.
I'm sorry, I haven't a clue.
Enama, a tool for itching chickens.
A new series of the self-styled antidote to panel games, chaired by Jack D.
Sorry, I said that out loud, I didn't mean to.
Featuring Marcus Brigstock, Miles Jupp, Rachel Paris and Adrian Edmondson.
Relax, don't do it.
Absolute filth, and I think you know it.
I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. Monday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Simon King can tell us what the weather looks like today. Hello, Simon.
Hello, Anna. Good morning. Yes, good morning, everybody. We have got some showery rain in the forecast today, but really throughout the week, it's going to stay quite unsettled. There'll be further spells of rain, some that could be quite heavy, particularly for the middle part of the week. So just something we're keeping a close eye on at the moment. But for southwest England and Wales, we've got some showers across southwest England. Those could turn increasingly heavy and thundery for a time, spreading their way northward across into Wales through this morning. By this afternoon, there'll be some sunnier spells developing and maximum temperatures getting up to about 9 to 12 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, some showery rain, light and patchy rain really actually across the southeast of England this morning. That should mostly clear away. Quite cloudy really for most areas, but some limited brightness developing before further showers start to spread their way in from the south and the west. Maximum temperatures about 12 to 14 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, it's pretty cloudy to start this morning. There'll be some sunny spells developing, especially in northeast England. Showers coming into the northwest, highs of 11 to 14 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland today, some rain likely at times across northern parts. The best of dry, bright weather across the south, temperatures of 9 or 10 Celsius. And finally, for Scotland, quite a chilly start, especially in the far north of Scotland. We've got some rain that's edging its way northward at the moment across some central and northern areas, continuing to push north and westward. Some dry, bright weather for eastern and southern Scotland into the afternoon, and temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. Good morning from Nick Robinson and from Anna Foster. It is 8 o'clock on Monday the 10th of November. The headlines this morning: the BBC chairman will respond to criticism of the way Panorama edited a Donald Trump speech after the Director General and the BBC head of news resigned. We'll hear from the chair of the group of MPs who've demanded answers on that Panorama episode. The US Senate has approved a deal that paves the way to end the federal government shutdown, and the Syrian president, who once fought for Al-Qaeda, will have talks today at the White House.
Also in the next hour, from the son of a Welsh miner to acting royalty, a new documentary tells the story of Richard Burton's life and career. And the prize-winning author Dame Penelope Lively tells us what's special about writing for children, ahead of her speech launching the Booker Prize for Children's Literature.
There's this extraordinary liberation about it. The writer of children's books can kind of discard the boundaries of time and place.
Before all of that, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The BBC is facing calls to take action to restore trust as it begins a search for a new Director General and Head of News. Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus announced their resignations yesterday evening after criticism of how a Panorama documentary edited a speech by President Trump. The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, is expected to address their departures today when he responds to concerns about editorial standards raised by a committee of MPs. Here's our media correspondent, David Sillitoe.
The original plan for today was that the BBC would merely provide answers to the Commons Media Select Committee about why a clip of a Donald Trump speech in a Panorama was spliced together from two separate sections, 54 minutes apart. But events have moved on, with not one but two resignations. Tim Davey, the Director General, said it wasn't the whole reason he had chosen to go, but no one doubts it certainly determined the timing. The chief executive of News, Deborah Turnus, said the controversy around Panorama was causing damage to the BBC and mistakes had been made, but denied BBC News was institutionally biased. That issue had been raised by Michael Prescott, a former independent editorial advisor at the BBC whose concerns led to a series of stories in the papers. He will meet MPs later this week. The BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, said it was a difficult day for the BBC. What began as a series of questions about a panorama has become a crisis, with the corporation now looking for candidates for its two biggest jobs.
The resignations of Tim Davie and Deborah Turnus have been welcomed by President Trump. Writing on social media, he said they had been caught doctoring his speech, and he accused them of trying to step on the scales of a presidential election. With her analysis of where the episode leaves the BBC, here's our media editor, Katie Razzle.
On the face of it, Tim Davies' departure makes some sense. As his statement makes clear, the Director General had been under intense personal and professional pressure. As the controversies mounted, he didn't seem his usual buoyant self. My assessment is that he didn't have enough oil in the tank for another fight. The claims about Panorama and the edit of President Trump's speech were very damaging to the BBC. The corporation needed to get on the front foot and either apologise or defend itself. I understand a statement had been prepared days ago to apologise, but that was blocked by the board. I'm told there was outright hostility towards the CEO of News, Deborah Turnus, in a crisis meeting on Thursday. It had decided a letter to the Culture, Media and Sport Committee was preferable. But for a week, claims about the BBC and editorial bias were allowed to fester. It's a moment of real crisis for the corporation, and there will be questions about who governs it.
The former editor of The Sun, David Yelland, who co-presents the Radio 4 podcast When It Hits the Fan, told us the resignations were a victory for toxic plotters who had acted from within to bring down the head of the BBC and his most senior journalist.
It was a coup, and worse than that, there were people inside the BBC, very close to the board, on the board, who have systematically undermined Tim Davie and his senior team over a period of a long time. What happened yesterday didn't just happen in isolation. I think it's important to understand that.
The former editor of the Daily Telegraph, Lord Moore, told us that instead of focusing on claims of a coup, the BBC should report the criticisms of its journalism. He said the resignations should be good for the corporation as they would focus minds on impartial coverage and respecting diversity of opinion.
All the BBC's bias goes in one direction, always from a sort of metropolitan left position. So that means that it's not serving a very, very large percentage of the licence fee payers. I'm not, of course, saying that it should be right-wing either. I'm saying it should take impartiality seriously and put in people capable of running this gigantic and self-satisfied bureaucracy.
Some MPs are now calling for the government to bring forward its review of the BBC's charter. With his thoughts on how yesterday's resignations could shape the corporation's future, here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
The size of the BBC and its funding model means it has always been, will always be, plenty say should always be, subject to the highest scrutiny. For politicians of every political persuasion, it is not just another organisation which they can be detached from or disinterested in. They will have a personal experience of it alongside any political view. The sharpest criticisms of the BBC historically and recently often but not always come from the right. What comes next for the government and whoever the BBC finds to lead it is a negotiation about its charter, which sets out its purpose, governance and funding. The current charter expires at the end of 2027. That conversation will take place against a backdrop of colossal change in the global media landscape. And plenty ponder how publicly funded and commercial UK-based media, providing news and wider programming, can survive, even thrive, when the internet in all its guises, streaming, social media, has upended so much.
The US Senate has approved a deal aimed at ending the government shutdown that's lasted nearly 6 weeks. Many government operations have ground to a halt and hundreds of thousands of federal workers have gone without pay. Anthony Zerka reports from Washington.
The longest government shutdown in US history may not be over yet, but an end appears to be in sight. 8 Democrats in the 100-seat Senate joined all but one of the Republicans to approve a stopgap measure that will fund all government services until the end of January. In addition, a few government departments and programs, including low-income food aid, will be funded until October. Democrats had been demanding an extension of health insurance subsidies for tens of millions of Americans, but they made little progress, with Republicans only agreeing to put that to a vote in the Senate. The House of Representatives will also have to approve the funding bill before it can be sent to Donald Trump for his signature.
The Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, will have talks with President Trump today. He'll be the first Syrian leader to visit the White House since his country's independence nearly 80 years ago. Here's our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman.
The US once had a $10 million bounty on Ahmed al-Sharaa's head. Today, he walks into the White House, the guest of Donald Trump, an extraordinary turnaround for the leader who once headed an al-Qaeda affiliate, but whose rebel alliance ousted the Assad regime. The Syrian president will seek more sanctions relief for his country's devastated cash-based economy, while Mr. Trump wants Damascus to join the US-led coalition against the Islamic State group. The goal for Washington is to solidify the dramatic shifts in the region as Iranian and Russian influence has collapsed in Syria, but sectarian tensions remain strong, with growing signs Mr. al-Sharaa is not delivering the inclusive governance the West wanted.
The United Nations Climate Change Summit, COP30, opens today in the Brazilian city of Belém. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has said he wants the talks to deliver concrete action on cutting greenhouse gases. The US has said it won't be sending any high-level delegates. Leaked documents seen by the BBC show a young woman tried to harm herself at a hospital 4 months after another mental health patient had died there in similar circumstances. The trust will be sentenced tomorrow for health and safety breaches related to the patient's death. Our social affairs editor Alison Holt reports.
Alice Figueiredo died in July 2015 whilst a patient at Goodmayes Hospital, part of the North East London NHS Mental Health Trust. She had previously tried to harm herself using plastic bags or bin bags 18 times. On the 19th occasion, she could not be revived. An internal trust document seen by the BBC shows that just 4 months later, another young woman tried to harm herself using a bin bag on the same ward. The similarities are described as startling. The trust says bin bags have been removed and it is committed to learning from every incident.
A new schools inspection system begins in England today. Schools will be given one of five grades in several different categories. Overall judgments such as good or requires improvement have been scrapped. Here's our education reporter Vanessa Clark.
The changes are being brought in following the death of the head teacher Ruth Purry, who took her own life after her school's Ofsted inspection. Schools will now be inspected using a colour-coded grading scale across several areas, as well as being given a pass or fail on safeguarding. But the changes have proved controversial. After losing a bid to challenge the plans in court, the National Association of Head Teachers is now considering strike action. But Ofsted says the new system will be better for parents.
That was our education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It is 8:10. Within the next 2 years, a decision needs to be taken by politicians about whether the BBC should survive in its current form, whether you should have to pay a licence fee to fund it, not just for the things you probably love, Traitors, Strictly, The Proms and all the rest of it, free-to-air sport, but of course this, news. News on Radio 4, news online, news on television as well. That debate about what the BBC should be like and how it should be funded is taking place at a time of deep political and cultural divisions. And that's why it's important to ask this morning what has happened and what is happening at the BBC. Now, in normal times, you might be forgiven for dismissing those questions as navel-gazing by folk like me who can't resist talking about ourselves. In normal times, you know, I'd be inclined to agree with you. These, though, are not normal times. The boss of the organisation, which remains, despite all the rows about bias, the most trusted news organisation in this country, perhaps across the globe, has quit, along with the head of news, after a row in which the President of the United States denounced what he called the doctoring of what he was presented as saying on a BBC Panorama programme. Now, ever since the first rumours of those resignations surfaced yesterday afternoon, I've been piecing together what happened which led to this crisis. Those at the top of the BBC have appeared paralysed for the past week, unable to agree what to say, not just about the editing of Donald Trump's speech by Panorama, but also wider claims of institutional bias, yes, against Trump, but also against Israel, against feminists standing up for their rights, against those advocating trans rights. One source has described the arguments that have raged ever since the Telegraph published a leaked memo by a former advisor to the BBC board as like armed conflict. Another alleged political interference after what they described as a hostile takeover of parts of the BBC. Now, the BBC is run by a board made up of the leaders of the major divisions of the corporation, including BBC News, but also part-time directors appointed by the government of the day. BBC News executives, the journalists who run the news division, agreed the wording of a statement at the beginning of last week, admitting that it had been a mistake to edit together two different sections of Donald Trump's speech, the speech given on the day of the Capitol Hill riots. And they said it had been a mistake to make that edit without clearly signalling to the audience that the edit had been made. That statement would have concluded that despite this error, there was no intention to mislead the audience. That, though, was not enough for the BBC board, which refused to sign off the statement. The report it had received from Michael Prescott, an independent advisor to the BBC's Editorial Guidelines and Standards Board, until June of this year, stated that the Panorama film, and I quote, created the impression that Trump said something he did not, and in so doing, materially misled viewers. The argument which raged on the BBC board ensured that the BBC neither defended itself nor admitted its mistakes for day after long day after the leaking of the Prescott dossier alleging that institutional bias. As criticism mounted from the White House, from former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, from the newspapers, from many others, the BBC only said that it would not comment on leaked documents, whilst promising that the chairman of the BBC, Samir Shah, would respond in writing to MPs on the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee. We are still waiting for that letter. In her resignation statement last night, the chief executive of BBC News, Deborah Tenness, stated that the ongoing controversy around the Panorama on President Trump has reached a stage where it's causing damage to the BBC, an institution that I love. Neither she nor the outgoing Director General, Tim Davey, explained what they had thought had gone wrong, and they were not available for interview this morning to explain that. Now, a majority of the BBC board appears to agree with their editorial advisor that there is indeed a problem of institutional bias reflected in the coverage of Trump and Gaza and trans rights. That argument has been led in particular by one board member, Sir Robbie Gibb, a former BBC executive who used to be in charge of political programmes here, but who went on to become a partisan. He was Prime Minister Theresa May's Downing Street Director of Communication. He was one of those involved in the founding of GB News. Friends of Sir Robbie insist he's repeatedly and consistently supported Tim Davey as Director General and wanted him to stay in his job and has written articles supporting the BBC and the licence fee. A final reflection on the problems the BBC's had before I turn to our culture editor and indeed a former executive here at the BBC to reflect on what's been going on. As of last night, after a week, after those resignations, the BBC's board, all 15 members, had still not agreed the wording of the statement due to be made today by the chairman, Samir Shah. As we broadcast, I do not know whether that statement has been agreed, but we have, of course, asked for it, and we've asked for an interview with Mr. Shah as well. Well, let's turn, first of all, to reflect on all this to our culture and media editor, Katie Razzle. Morning to you, Katie.
Morning, Nick.
Now, you've written at length on the BBC website about what's gone wrong. In a sense, after my long-winded explanation, I wonder if we can simplify it all. Isn't the truth there has been a mighty great row between the people who run BBC News day to day and the board who are meant to supervise them, who don't actually believe they're doing their job properly?
Yes, I think that is right. And it is striking that on the same day last week that the BBC was basking in the glory of bringing millions in the country together for the Celebrity Traitors final, its CEO of News was, as it's been put to me, being ripped apart at a board meeting over impartiality in News. And what I've been hearing is exactly what you said earlier this morning, that the News operation wanted last week to get on the front foot about the Panorama edit of the Donald Trump speech. They wanted to apologise and say they hadn't meant to mislead and that they were blocked by the board. But importantly, I have also been told that that is a mischaracterisation, that in fact people inside News were still defending the Trump edit last week and there wasn't the clarity on what the BBC position was. And there is a feeling amongst board members, I believe, that last week was too late, that there were opportunities much earlier to look at that edit because it had been flagged to them much earlier and say it was wrong and that they didn't take that opportunity. And then, of course, as you've been discussing all morning, there are those who say what happened, as one put it to me, was the culmination of a relentless critique of BBC journalism over 2 years by some members of the board and advisers, all of whom, as it was put to me, come from the same political persuasion. I mean, there's no doubt more's going to emerge. I suppose people looking in might say the BBC knows it faces opposition from various quarters, potentially even inside its own board, who knows, but that makes it even more important that it protects itself by ensuring it doesn't show bias, and the Trump edit has caused it no end of problems. I mean, I know people working for the BBC in the US who are absolutely furious about the difficult situation it's put them in, and it does look like a complete own goal.
To clarify for people who don't understand the structures here, the people who run BBC News, as well as you and me, our appointments are nothing to do with governments, politicians at all. Nothing. They have no say, unlike in other countries. However, those part-timers, what in the code is called, in the jargon, if you like, non-executive directors, they are appointed by government, aren't they? And the controversy here amongst those people who claim a coup, and I quote to you the Observer that has just now put out on its website a claim that these resignations should be called out for what they are, political interference that will inhibit the work of BBC journalists and undermine the public's trust in BBC News. Why do I read you the Observer's view? Well, because the editor-in-chief of The Observer used to be the head of News here at the BBC, a man called James Hardy, who many people regarded as a candidate to be the next Director General. I think he's just written an editorial signalling it's not a job he wants. But the allegation they're all making, Katie, is that people appointed by Boris Johnson with the job of nobbling the BBC have finally nobbled the BBC.
Yes, that is correct. And obviously it's contentious. And there will be plenty of people looking in from the outside going, hold on a minute, you inside the BBC, in fact, Charles Moore effectively said it earlier, you inside the BBC are turning this into a row about people taking over the BBC for political reasons, when actually what this is a row about is the fact that you need to be held accountable for the fact that, as they see it, there is still institutional groupthink, systemic bias, whatever you want to call it, inside the BBC. Now, that is obviously something that not just people in News, but I believe the board is going to push back on some of those claims. You've been talking earlier, I think, about the fact that the committee, the Culture, Media and Sport Committee, that the board is drafting this letter. I agree with you. I'm not sure if it is actually finished, but it is going to go to the Culture, Media and Sport Committee later today. And my understanding is that it will, of course, apologise for the Trump edit in the Panorama, but it will also push back on the notion that the BBC is systemically biased, while accepting there are some issues that need addressing and that have been addressed. Katie. Just one note on the...
Yep. Yeah. Sorry, forgive me. We've got to move on to Mark Damaser and indeed the chair of that committee. But yeah, last thought from you.
I was just going to say one note on the coup, if it was a coup, and there's been debate on that. I don't think it was aimed at Tim Davey. You know, he's overseen a series of controversies, but I think he had the confidence of the board. And I think that explains why there was such shock when he announced his resignation to them over the weekend.
In other words, they wanted the head of News. They got the head of News, his scalp, and then Tim Davey chose to resign. Let's turn then to Mark Damaser, who's former controller of this network, former controller of BBC Radio 4, a former member of the BBC's governing body, so understands the way in which it is run and organised as well. Good morning to you, Mark. For many people listening to this who don't know the BBC as you and I do, they'll just say, what a god-awful mess, won't they?
Well, it matters because the BBC, although we all have to pay for it and there's resentment about that, we all own it and we all feel very passionately about it. And this is a raucous and pluralist and difficult democracy, and public debate has now been coarsened by social media and the introduction of identity politics as a whole new raft of issues, which create tension and division, and the BBC has to handle, make it very, very difficult to navigate. And year after year after year of crashing waves against the Director General has taken its toll. I'm very, very sad about it. I think Tim is an outstanding Director General. So I think it both matters. I think it's a shame that it's happened. I welcome the debate about the BBC's impartiality and its journalism. And I don't agree with Charles Moore, estimable though he is and valuable though he is in the national debate, that the BBC is systemically biased. And that it's basted in a culture which means that its journalism can't be trusted. I think that's absolutely wrong. I think the vast majority of what the BBC does, the overwhelming, overwhelming majority, is excellent, and it doesn't happen by accident. The BBC employs extremely good journalists. It has a deep and wide culture in which impartiality is centre. It largely succeeds in doing so. It is, of course, imperfect. We can talk about the errors. But I'm here to say that the BBC is an outstanding and excellent exponent of impartial journalism, and it needs to be defended.
Well, let's talk about those areas then, because what the report that was produced for the board said, above and beyond the controversy around one edit in one television programme, was, look, the debate on trans rights was censored by journalists within the BBC. They did not want to hear, they did not wish to report the views of those commonly known as gender critical, of feminists who disagree with the extension of the rights of trans women if it curtails their rights. They say, listen to the British Jewish community, whose representative bodies, all of them, said the BBC discriminates against the views of British Jews and in particular is anti-Israel. Those are real views held by people who have no real wider political agenda, aren't they?
Well, of course they are, and they need to be both respected and interrogated, but they're not the same as saying that's the truth of the measure of the BBC's journalism. We can take them one by one. So on transgender and women's rights, I absolutely think that it would be perfectly proper if there were a forensic and deep look at the way the BBC's handled it. I only listen to what I listen to, and I watch what I watch. And from what I can experience myself, there may have been an occasional mistake accepted, but in the round, I don't think that it's one-sided journalism. I know that people feel very strongly about it on both sides. The BBC has to navigate it. It hasn't navigated it perfectly, but I don't see a whole systemic problem there about the way the BBC has handled it. I might be wrong, but all I can say is that I don't accept as gospel truth the fact that one side or the other particularly cries foul means that that is so. Similarly, on Israel-Gaza, I read and I hear. Charles said that the complaints only ever come from one side. That's not true. There are many, many who are sympathetic to the Palestinian cause in the UK who feel the BBC hasn't been good enough. I don't happen to agree with them either from what I listen to and what I see. But it's not the case that it's only one side that's complaining. And on Israel-Gaza, the cause célèbre earlier this year with this documentary, which in my view probably should not have been commissioned. So I accept that it was a significant error. You would think from the way that it was reported that the BBC asked no significant questions, that all the people concerned in the command and control of that programme were dumb, idiotic, foolish or duped. I've read the report in the footnotes. That's not the case either. The BBC was right to apologise for it. But the notion that there's this widespread, satisfied, smug, liberal, incompetent culture which pollutes and contaminates the BBC's journalism, all of it and all of you, and in some way the whole thing is rotten to the core and needs top-to-bottom reform, is wildly, wildly overblown and is extremely disrespectful of the work that not only you, but thousands of journalists across the BBC manage day by day. And somebody needs to stand up and say, yes, mistakes are made. It's interesting to discuss what they are and to try and get the currency of complaint and correction correct. But these people are not dolts, and this quality journalism does not happen by accident.
When you say someone should stand up, a final thought before we turn to the chair of the select committee that's going to hear from Samir Char, isn't he the person who should be standing up? Why have we had silence, not just for a week, but also on the morning after the resignation? We still do not have leadership, do we?
All right, fair question. I hope I'm not disqualified by saying I know Samir Shah. And by the way, anybody who knows him knows that he's no liberal pushover of any kind. He's a highly, highly experienced an extremely credible journalist. So we'll get the answer to the question. And it may be that there's something going on in the board. Nick, you've reported on it. Katie's just reported on it, which might explain this. I mean, what I would say about the governance is that it's always the governance. Every time something goes wrong, people point the finger at governance. It happened when I was on the BBC Trust. Oh, if only we had a different system, it would be fine. Look, mistakes will happen. There's a real debate about whether the BBC correctly calibrates the language of correction and what that might be and how it could be improved. And that might apply to this case and the Trump edit. I accept all of that. And I think that those members of the board who want to be on the board as it were, non-executive directors, ought each and every one of them come up before parliamentary scrutiny and be made to sing for their supper before they're appointed. Because we know too little about them. I don't think they're properly interrogated before they take these posts. And that at least is a reform that should be carried out. But well, I don't think the whole thing is about governance. It's about trying to be proportionate and reasonable and calibrate successfully the BBC's errors, because there are, and the Trump one clearly was, and weigh that in the balance against the all-round excellence and quality of what the BBC does.
Mark Damizer, former controller of BBC Radio 4, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Dame Caroline Dynage is the Conservative Chair of the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
You and the committee are expecting a letter from the chairman, Samir Shah, today. I'm correct in saying that hasn't arrived with you yet, has it?
The letter hasn't arrived yet, and we still have no indication about what it will contain.
OK. But in terms of what we've seen unfold in the last 24 hours or so, on those resignations of the chairman and the CEO of BBC News, you weren't calling for resignations. And interesting, the Culture Secretary, Labour's Lisa Nandy, was asked about this on Laura Koonsberg's programme yesterday morning. She didn't call for resignations either. Do you think that those resignations were the right course of action?
Well, I think they were a very avoidable course of action. I'm very sad about Tim Davies stepping down. I think he was an effective leader at the BBC. I think he was a great champion for public service media. But there is no escaping the fact that he was very slow to act on this particular issue, but this isn't the first time. And on this particular issue, the Michael Prescott's report, he just didn't take it seriously until it was too late. He should have reacted with concern and examined the claims, but just ignored it. But, you know, I do feel it was entirely avoidable, and it's really regretful given the huge commitment to the BBC and public service that Tim Davies demonstrated.
It's interesting that you say that he ignored it, because what we're sort of trying to dig into this morning is whether or not it was ignored, or whether there was this crisis at the heart of the BBC board, which meant that a statement couldn't be agreed and put out. Is that something that you've had any indication of in your dealings with the board, that there is a rift at the heart of it?
I don't know enough about the board to be able to comment on that. But, you know, as I say, we're still waiting for their letter. We have no indication what's in it. We haven't had a statement from them. And that seems a little bit odd. What I would say, though, is this issue was not of the board's making. This issue was of editorial guidelines and editorial guidelines not being followed. And even as late as the sort of middle of last week, people from the BBC were saying to me over the Donald Trump Panorama program, oh, it was just editing, that, you know, they couldn't get their head around the fact that how that editing had actually impacted the meaning of the documentary, and that it was effectively splicing. It was, you know, it was the sort of stuff that the BBC criticise others for doing and stand up as these paragons of reliable and broadcasting with great integrity, and, you know, and it was flying in the face of all those claims to be above all that. And to just present that as editing is just, you know, shows a massive oversight of what is at heart of the issue here.
Some of the most senior figures at the BBC have talked about there being a coup here, some kind of hostile takeover by elements within the board, elements who were politically appointed because the non-executive directors are appointed by the King on the recommendation of ministers. So I wonder, given that, do you think it is time for that appointment system to change? Do you think that there should be no ministerial involvement at all in the people who are chosen to be at the top of the BBC?
Well, I mean, I think the way that the board is selected is one thing, but I think the BBC are doing a really good job here of trying to obfuscate what the issue is. Tim Davies didn't stand down because the board asked him to. He stood down because of an editorial failure, and it's not the first time. I mean, there seems to be a muscle memory at the BBC as to how to badly respond to any kind of editorial crisis or scandal. And that's happened across the summer, you know, whether it was the Glastonbury coverage, whether it was the Gaza documentary, whether it was Greg Wallace on MasterChef. The BBC just seemed to drop the ball at every opportunity. And that's not a board level problem. That's an institutional problem. And that's, you know, replacing Tim Davey isn't going to sort that out. The BBC need to grip it right from the top, right to the bottom.
Dame Caroline Dynage, thank you for joining us.
It's 28 minutes to nine. Let's have a break from all this. Let's talk about the sport, shall we?
Yes, is this light relief? I'm not sure. Let's talk Formula One to begin, because Lando Norris says timing his good end-of-season form to perfection, it seems. The McLaren driver took another step towards winning a first Formula One World Championship yesterday with victory in Brazil at the Sao Paulo Grand Prix. He is now 24 points ahead of teammate and nearest title rival Oscar Piastri with just three race weekends to go. Meanwhile, in Rugby Union's Autumn Internationals, another chastening defeat for Wales yesterday. They were beaten 52-28 by Argentina in new head coach Steve Tandy's first match in charge. Now, though, let's talk football and reflect on the big game of the weekend in the Premier League.
Pep Guardiola turns to his right. He shakes hands with Arne Slot, and the Liverpool manager says well played to Manchester City's manager, who on his 1,000th match as a manager has recorded a super victory, really, against the champions Liverpool by 3-0.
It's a resounding victory for Manchester City yesterday. They move up to second in the Premier League after beating Liverpool 3-0. So who better to reflect on that than a man who played for both clubs? The former England goalkeeper David James joins us live on the programme. Hi, David.
Good morning, Mike.
Four wins in a row for Manchester City. They've actually won seven out of their last eight. They are hitting their stride, aren't they, seemingly, which I guess is ominous for their rivals.
Absolutely, yes. I was at the game yesterday, and I've got to say, I mean, there was obviously some controversy in there. There was drama. There was some poor play, perhaps, and there was some brilliance all in one. But what I saw from City yesterday was, at times, quite scary how much they control the game, certain areas of the game, and basically made Liverpool suffer.
Yeah, it was a great afternoon for City's forwards. Erling Haaland, naturally getting most of the headlines, scoring his 14th goal in 11 Premier League matches this season. I could even afford to miss a penalty, couldn't he, Haaland? But Jeremy Doku, want to mention him. He shone, didn't he, down the right for City yesterday, capped off with that pearler of a third goal.
Absolutely. I have to say, I'm not even sure if Erling Haaland had a shot for his goal, because it seems to take a deflection off Kanate and hit him. But when he lucks in, he lucks in. But Jeremy Doku, instrumental, I think. He got the penalty and was rightly awarded at times with Conor Bradley. He was giving him absolute nightmares. And the moment of brilliance, I think, was the third goal. I mean, it was absolutely terrific. The fact that he came off 63 minutes, I think, and got player of the match. I mean, that's how much of a performance he put in. It really was good.
And all on a great day for manager Pep Guardiola, who, as we heard in commentary there, was celebrating his 1,000th game as a manager, over half of those 1,000 games coming in charge of Manchester City. As for Liverpool, David, their mini revival stopped in its tracks yesterday. Some papers I see this morning already writing their title defence off, saying after five defeats in 11, there's just no way they can claw that back. They are out of the picture. Do you go along with that?
I don't agree. I work on the basis, Mike, 90 points will give you a chance of winning the title. With regards to Liverpool, that allows them three defeats. And essentially, without doing too clever maths, I think they have to win eight games in a row three times. They can afford to lose three matches, and that will give them a chance. However, given the way that City were playing yesterday, and obviously Arsenal with 8 points ahead of Liverpool, that gives those two, Chelsea in there as well, there's three teams there that Liverpool will have to hope don't do the same. But not written off yet. But I'm hopeful that Arne Slot can turn things around and make a big contest of it. But it's going to be tough.
They need the injured Alexander Isak back ASAP, don't they? Just briefly, David, you touched on it there. On a wider point, this form by City and Arsenal's form, it just sets up the title race nicely, doesn't it? Manchester City now 4 points behind leaders Arsenal, Chelsea looking to shoehorn their way into the picture, as you say, as we head into the second third of the season. The title race is still anyone's call.
Yeah. As I say, it's I wouldn't say it's wide open. There are only a few sides that you think would be contesting for it at the end of the season. But the way that Manchester City played yesterday, the way they've changed the way they've played in different games this season, I think they're going to give Arsenal a right good run for it. And as I say, I'm still hopeful that Arna and the Liverpool team can be in that conversation come the end of the season.
And there's someone in the studio who would probably think that if Manchester United can keep up their unbeaten run, then maybe they might also be potentially in the title picture. Too much of a stretch, Nick?
I'm not that optimistic.
Okay. David James, former England goalkeeper, former Manchester City and Liverpool player as well. Many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike. 23 minutes to nine. Start the week is here at nine. Adam Rutherford is here to tell us all about it. Morning.
Morning, Anna. So we've got planetary true crime today. We're not traipsing after podcast fads and fashions, but the crimes that result in serious ecological damage. So we're talking the Volkswagen Dieselgate scandal, the ivory trade, the Deepwater Horizon spill. We're also in pursuit of the Siberian tiger, more properly named the Amur tiger, solitary, iconic, endangered and heavily politicised beasts. And we have Tales from the End of the World, the fiction that emerges from the ongoing climate crisis. So we're less a COP30 talking shop and more action on green crime. Cli-fi, that's what we're calling climate fiction. And tigers prowling on Start of the Week at Nine. How do you feel about cli-fi?
New genre. Not sure it's going to catch on. Nice try, though. Yeah. That all with Adam at 9 o'clock. Quick look at the weather for then and the rest of the day. Unsettled with spells of rain for many. Sunny spells in the northeast and southwest at times.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, will address the resignations of the corporation's director general and head of news when he responds today to concerns about editorial standards raised by a committee of MPs. Tim Davey and Deborah Turner stepped down yesterday after criticism of the way a speech by President Trump was edited in a Panorama documentary. The Conservative MP, Dame Caroline Dynage, who chairs the Commons, Culture, Media and Sport Committee, told us Mr. Davey had been very slow to act and had not taken the issue seriously until it was too late. US senators have passed a deal which could bring an end to the longest government shutdown in American history. 8 Democrat senators voted to support a stopgap measure put forward by the Republicans to extend government funding until the end of January. The legislation now has to be passed by the House of Representatives. And the Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, will have talks with President Trump today. The US once had a $10 million bounty on Mr. Sharaa's head when he led a group affiliated with al-Qaeda.
Thank you, Alan. 21 minutes to nine. The latest ceasefire started in Gaza a month ago now. And one of the hopes was that it would lead to an improvement in the dire humanitarian situation for hundreds of thousands of people living in the Strip who'd been pummeled by war and who'd felt the impact of Israel restricting the normal amount of aid that it let into the territory. But 4 weeks on, the situation remains catastrophic and levels of suffering are still high. I spoke a little earlier to Caroline Willeman. She's Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF's project coordinator in Gaza. She's in Deir al-Balah.
The reality of what we see is less wounded, less dead arriving in our emergency rooms, though by no means the number of newly wounded is zero, unfortunately, because we've had several days of the ceasefire being broken completely, where we've been receiving both injured and dead in our emergency room. And then, yeah, in terms of humanitarian aid, there are trucks entering. The situation is not quite as dire as when I was here, for example, in July and August in Gaza City, when there was absolutely no food on the market. We see some food in the market now. At the same time, it remains insufficient, which we know because in our primary healthcare centers, we continue to diagnose cases of acute malnutrition every single day. So the fact that there is, for example, food in the market doesn't mean that everybody is able to access that food. And so that's an indicator of not sufficient humanitarian aid entering, certainly nowhere near the 600 trucks that were part of the ceasefire agreement.
And what are you still expecting, or are you getting what you need in terms of things like medical equipment? Because as you say there, the agreement made provision for a lot of extra food, water, humanitarian assistance to come in, but that is clearly not what you're seeing.
No, exactly. So we have had trucks coming in, but it's actually not at a significantly higher rate than pre-ceasefire. One of the key things we continue to struggle with, even if we have now been able to enter some of these items, are the dual-use items. So the items defined by the Israeli authorities as being possible for both civilian and military use. What this means for us is material for water sanitation, for sterilization of our materials in the hospital, external fixators for our patients with very complex broken bones, and these external fixators quite literally keep their bones together. So some of these we now start to be able to enter, but again, not at the rate that we need. And we continue to see very much this administrative bureaucratic blockage of the work we are trying to do. We've had trucks that are denied one day, and then 2 days later, the same trucks with the same items, with the same paperwork, they can come through. So indeed, it's difficult not to see this as a deliberate obstruction on the parts of the Israeli authorities, which is indeed something that we have been witnessing and experiencing for the past 2 years.
That's Carolyn Willman from MSF, who is in Deir al-Bala in Gaza at the moment, while our international editor Jeremy Bowen is also with us. Morning, Jeremy.
Morning.
Caroline touched on some of the issues there, but people will wonder why there is not more of an improvement after 4 weeks of ceasefire.
Well, that's because the Israelis are still restricting what's going in terms of humanitarian aid. They would argue that the big problem is that Hamas is not returning the remains of the hostages who are still there, the dead bodies and highly decomposed bodies by this time. The body of a soldier who was killed in 2014 has been returned. And there are lots of things going on around that, apart from the fact that there has been a slowness, a great slowness in trying to develop the things that will be necessary to move on to the second phase of the ceasefire, including an international force that would go in. That's still very much in its infancy, if barely getting off the ground. There's also an issue of 200 Hamas fighters who are said to be in tunnels under Rafah. Turkey calls them civilians, but I think it's pretty clear that they're Hamas people, and there are negotiations going on about giving them some kind of an amnesty to get back to Hamas-controlled Gaza, 45% of the territory. Hamas, at the same time, are reasserting their strength there. They've carried out executions in the streets. They've also carried out punishment beatings against people who they say have been working with the Israelis, breaking bones, breaking legs, breaking arms with clubs. So it's as well as the humanitarian side, there's an awful lot going on, and none of it is particularly positive.
When that ceasefire happened, Jeremy, it happened quite quickly, and it was driven very much by the momentum and the energy of President Trump. And at the time, people said, well, this level of interest needs to keep going to make sure that things do change. But as you're saying there, really the speed of some of what needed to happen to give this the momentum to be a success, it is simply not happening.
Yeah, and I know that senior Western foreign ministers and diplomats are concerned about the way that all the sort of the superstructure, the scaffolding of agreements that you need to make a ceasefire lasting, that's happening really slowly in terms of the way that the ceasefire supervisory mechanism has been developed, the necessary UN resolutions, which still have not been passed. There is a draft now circulating, one that would authorize an international force to go in there. And also big questions about what exactly is the future. And there are people, there's one opinion which is quite, firming up now, that what we might well be looking at is a long-term division of Gaza between the 55% of the territory that Israel controls and the rest of it, which is essentially under Hamas control. Suggestions that there may be development and rebuilding in the Israeli controlled side, but Israel taking measures to make sure that nothing like that happens on the Hamas controlled side. So a freezing perhaps, but that is not a way to build a better future for anybody.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you.
It is now 9:15. The winner of the Booker Prize, the most prestigious literary award in the English-speaking world, is going to be announced tonight. The shortlisted authors and the guests are in for a treat at the prize ceremony in London, not just because they'll hear the winner, but because they're going to hear from Dame Penelope Lively, a former winner of the prize, a great author not just of adult fiction, but of children's fiction too. At the age of 92, Dame Penelope is speaking to mark the launch of a new children's Booker Prize, the emphasis on the word children. It'll be the first time the Booker has celebrated the best contemporary fiction for children aged between 8 and 12 years old. I've been to speak to Dame Penelope at her home and asked her whether she was surprised there'd never been a Booker for children's literature.
Well, I now am surprised that there's never been one, and I can't think why we haven't been agitating for it. But now that there is, it's going to shine a light, I hope, on children's literature in a way that children's literature is always needing it. It's going to do a great deal, obviously, for writers of children's books, not necessarily the ones who win it or are shortlisted for it, but just the general feeling that, oh, no, here is a big grown-up prize for what they're so valuably doing. And I think that's what it is. It's a big, valuable, well-known prize, and it's needed. It's terrific.
And for writers, the value of the Booker is not just in literally the value, the prize money, but the status.
Oh, very much so, yes, very much so. Almost more than the money, I think.
You were a well-established writer. You'd written children's books, adult books, by the time that you won the Booker. What difference did it make to you to win it?
I think initially it made the difference that for a year I did nothing but sort of trot round the globe doing things for it, and I couldn't get on with the book that I wanted to write next. It was very reassuring, yes, it was incredibly reassuring.
Was it reassuring because, by definition, a writer's life is a solitary life, and this is an external recognition, not just sales, but something about quality and value?
Absolutely, yes, good point. Yes, it is a very solitary life, and I don't know, I think certainly I am always doubtful about my own work. I think a lot of writers are. I remember what Kingsley Amis apparently said, which was, a bad review can spoil breakfast, but it's not going to spoil lunch. Well, for me, it would have spoiled breakfast and lunch for days and days on end.
So you could breakfast and lunch and have dinner very happily, having won the Booker. Now, it's a different Booker Prize, because it is for children's literature. Having written both, having been successful as a writer of both adult and children's literature, what's the difference?
Children's literature, it's a maverick, idiosyncratic, very special, particular area of literature. There's this extraordinary liberation about it. The writer of children's books can kind of discard the boundaries of time and place. There's no sense whatsoever in which Alice is tethered to time. Alice kind of floats free. Yes, an awful lot of the references and the ideas are obviously 19th century ones. That never seems to matter. That never anchors it in any way. It floats beyond that.
In the speech that you're giving at the Booker Prize ceremony tonight, you quote Auden.
Auden had it absolutely wrapped up. What he said was, there are good books that are only for adults because their comprehension presupposes adult experiences, but there are no good books that are only for children. Absolutely so. You couldn't put it more succinctly and more neatly. If you're writing a children's book, you write out of your own adult interests and concerns, but you kind of temper them, you tweak them. Above all, you don't write down to children. You find a different register. You find a gear change, as it were. And so I would want a child to come away from reading a book that I'd written, feeling that there was something behind and beyond it that the child couldn't quite put a finger on, but that was sort of rather intriguing. And what that is a sort of breath from the future. It's a kind of breath from what the child is one day going to be able to know and understand, so that they're... The book is carrying a kind of unseen baggage that the child is not bothered by, but is sort of aware that it's there and thinks it's a bit interesting and it doesn't quite know what it is.
It frustrates some writers that these days it's much easier for a celebrity, someone who gets their celebrity off television, for example, to write successful children's books than it is for an author who's unknown.
Well, I don't know. Are these celebrity books successful? They're probably successful in marketing terms, but are they successful in literary terms?
That's quite an important distinction.
For me, it is the distinction, yes.
And is it the distinction that the booker is actually about?
Oh, yes, of course. The booker is interested in literary merit. The booker is bringing, whether it's for the adult book or the children's book, or is bringing erudite judges to pass judgment on this. And as an innovation, as a wonderful and necessary innovation for the children's booker, after the adult judges have selected a short list of eight, then three child judges are going to be brought in to read the shortlist and add their comments to those of the adult judges, which I think is wonderful.
It is wonderful. And if I may say so, so's Dame Penelope Lively. It was a real privilege to meet her and interview her. And you will be able to hear live on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds at 9:30 tonight the announcement of the winner of the Adult Booker Prize. I've no doubt hear an interview with the winner the next day as well.
Over on Radio 3 this morning, they are playing John Adams' The Chairman Dances, which depicts a youthful Chairman Mao dancing the foxtrot with his mistress. It's taken from Adams' opera Nixon in China, and you can hear it now if you flick over to Radio 3, or you can stay here if you'd like to. We'd like you to.
Yeah, we'll stay here to reflect on whether anybody can lead the BBC, because rather like many of our institutions, we are getting used to the idea of resignations and panics and crises. And there are serious people asking serious questions about whether the job is doable at all, not just the Director General's job, but the job of the chairman of the BBC. We are waiting, let's remember, for a statement from him, Sam Ayersha, later this morning on what's gone wrong. To reflect on all of that, Alan Rusbridger, the former editor of The Guardian, now editor of Prospect magazine, and also the presenter of a podcast that focus on these issues. He'll tell us the title because I'm afraid, Alan, I've temporarily forgotten it. And Simon Lewis is here, former Director of Communications for Her Majesty the Queen, the late Queen, for Gordon Brown as Prime Minister and now co-host of When It Hits the Fan here on Radio 4. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Give us the title, Alan, so I get it right. What's the name?
Media Confidential.
Media Confidential. There we are. There we are. Simon, first of all, is it an undoable job, Director General of the BBC?
Well, there are some jobs in British public life which I think are undoable. Archbishop of Canterbury, manager of the men's football team, Home Secretary and Director General of the BBC. Why have three of the last five Director Generals had to resign? By the way, I think Tim Davies has done an excellent job. And the reason is because, first of all, the job is too big and there probably needs to be a separation of responsibilities. But secondly, the pressure that you are under as a Director General, any of these public roles, becomes more and more intense, irrespective of what kind of challenges there are. And it's difficult to imagine unless you've been in that role yourself. Every day, every week, there's another new issue. And what you have to do is to try and be in a position where not only are you dealing with the issue, but you're having to see what's coming down the track. So, frankly, 5 years in a job like this, to me, is pretty good going. But I think we've all got to ask ourselves how we make these jobs more doable.
It is worth noting, by the way, that he resigned. He wasn't sacked. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it was a shock to many on the BBC board that he had resigned. In other words, it's not one of those, you know, did he jump, was he pushed? No. He did choose to resign. Alan Rusbridger, do you agree with that analysis?
I think it's a fantastically difficult job. He's got to be editor-in-chief of an organisation that pumps out, I think, 32,000 hours of content a year. And he's got to be on top of that and answerable to anybody who makes a mistake in any of that output. But he's also in charge of an organisation which has revenues of about £6 billion. So that's a very big corporate role as well. And I think there is an argument that should be explored as to whether you need an editor-in-chief and then somebody who is a commercial or COO who can look after the business of keeping the show on the road.
Talking of keeping the show on the road, Alan, you wrote yesterday on Prospect website, the BBC has bigger impartiality problems than its coverage of Trump. You believe there is a problem on the board.
Yeah, it's a very odd board. The main board, I counted 3 out of 13 who have any experience of journalism in the 21st century. And then there's a curious small group called the Editorial Standards Group, which has 5 people. This is a bit nerdy, but bear with me. 5 people, 3 of whom are insiders. That's Sam Ayersha, the chairman, Tim Davie, and Deborah Turnus, head of news, and 2 outsiders. And until recently, only one of those outsiders had any experience of journalism, and that was Robbie Gibb, appointed by Boris Johnson. who couldn't possibly claim to be impartial. He was a spin doctor for the Conservative Party. And so I think this is where a lot of the problems have arisen, that this strange little body, which is the only body which is there to look at standards and guidelines, which I think is a complete pantomime horse.
Simon, you co-present your podcast with David Yelland. Earlier on the programme was alleging there'd been a coup by Sir Robbie. He didn't name him, but it's clear who he meant. Alan, I think, agrees broadly with that analysis. Is that right, or do you think that's just a fundamental problem? The BBC's been getting things wrong and some people have called it out.
Well, I completely agree with Alan. I think the governance of the BBC is a challenge. I mean, every single crisis Dave and I have looked at in the corporate world, there's always been a governance failure at its root. And one of the challenges here has been, as you've said already, why did it take a week for the governing body to agree a statement? I mean, when we looked at the Buckingham Palace issue, right, Andrew, one of the challenges and questions there was, why did it take so long? There were good reasons, but the problem is, given the current environment, people will not wait. So I think questions must be asked about the board and why it didn't act more quickly.
I'm just being informed, by the way, they still haven't agreed the statement. So this is not just a, well, we've signed it off first thing in the morning.
Well, it's
as we broadcast at 5 to 9 on the morning after the resignation of the top two people, the BBC board is still, as I am informed, arguing about what to say about it. Al, it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
It's a shambles. And the thing is, I've watched the Panorama programme, which is quite difficult to watch now because the BBC has taken it down over the weekend. And apart from that really bad mistake, the programme is fine. I mean, it does two things. It tries to anticipate what a Trump's presidency would be like, and in that way, it slightly underestimated what it's going to be like, what it was like. And it also does a rather good job of explaining why Trump is so popular, was so popular, and why he appealed to so many people. The programme is fine, apart from a bad mistake. And the BBC could have come out earlier, said, we fixed the mistake, we made a mistake, we apologise, but defend the programme. And that hasn't happened. And the programme, I wish the programme was there so people could watch it for itself.
Simon, you mix in circles in which there'll be people saying, well, Alan Rusbridger would say that because he's from the Guardian. He's an old lefty. Forgive me, Alan. That's what they'd say about you. And he's defending a bunch of sort of lefties at the BBC. And the truth is they get it wrong on a whole series of things. We all know they do. If you went into the newsroom now and said who wanted Donald Trump to be president, you know, you might spot the guy who fills the coffee machine, but you wouldn't find many journalists. And they've sort of got a point, haven't they?
They have, but let's be honest, it's the most trusted news source in the world, and certainly the UK, so the BBC's doing something right. I do think it's a slightly hysterical period, actually, and I think the real concern is the BBC is rudderless as it goes into what is coming down the track, which is going to be one of the biggest negotiations with government for years.
30 seconds then on the each on the biggest question. Which is, there are people listening who might just say, you just don't need the BBC anymore. I mean, you know, modern technology has changed. There's a million places to get your news. Do you, Simon, when you look ahead, think this organisation will still exist in a form quite similar to this in 10 years' time?
Well, we've got two grandchildren. I'll go further than that. I think, yes, even 30 or 40 years, but it'll have to metamorphose in response to the kind of concerns that are being expressed.
Alan Rusbridger?
Well, look at America. Social media in the hands of a few billionaires. Nobody knowing what to believe, a president declaring war on the media and suing the media. If we want that kind of polarized media where nobody knows what to believe, go right ahead. If you don't want that, stick with the BBC.
Alan Rusbridger, presenter of Media Confidential. Simon Lewis, presenter of When It Hits the Fan. Thank you very much. Been lovely.